Chapter 14. Wilson was now 129 days into the mission, and counting. In the same way everyone else on board the Second Chance was counting. Days, hours, minutes, every little unit was being ticked off with a combination of irritation and relief. Their problem, strangely enough, was just how well the starship had worked since they departed Oaktier. He supposed it was inevitable. Enough money had been poured into the design, making sure every component had multiple redundancy, along with at least a 200% tolerance rating. In his NASA days, they'd call it gold plating. Everything on Ulysses had to work, and if some bizarre mishap did knock out a unit, then three backup systems jumped up to replace it. And that was when you could still see Earth through the viewing port, while communications with Houston took a few minutes at the most. It provided a tenuous feeling of connection to the rest of the human race that had always given him a degree of security. If something had gone badly wrong, he'd always believed that NASA would ultimately do something to salvage the situation. Today, though, the sense of isolation was stronger by orders of magnitude. Even he, with his previous experience, found their flight daunting. Should anything go wrong here in hyperspace, nobody was ever going to find them. It made him grateful for the way the starship had been constructed. This mission, he realized, had an altogether more mature feel to it than the Ulysses flight ever had. It was a civilized voyage. First of all, there was the gravity. It might only be an eighth of a G around the rim of the life support wheel, but it made sure everything flowed in the right direction. His body was so much more comfortable with that. Then there was the food. Instead of neat, efficient, rehydratable packets of pre-cooked meals, the Second Chance canteen served dishes like pan-fried diver scallops with herb risotto, or loin of lamb with tarte tatin of vegetables, drizzled with a thyme and tomato sauce. And the dessert selection was dangerously broad. For recreation, there were a number of gyms, which everyone dutifully attended. But most of the crew spent their spare time accessing TSI dramas. They had a huge library on board, with sex soaps inevitably the most popular, though First Life, First Romances were equally fashionable, and there were numerous adaptations of classic fiction and biographies of historical characters. Wilson spent several days immersed in a sumptuous production of Mansfield Park. He'd read the novel in his first life, and was interested in the societal structure of the era that it conjured up, intriguing parallel with present-day Earth, he felt, though he was fairly sure there hadn't been quite so many lesbian love scenes in the original book. Between fitness sessions, meals, TSIs, and ship's duty, he spent most of his hours with Anna. Even after all this time, he still preferred a one-woman-at-a-time lifestyle. The kind of arrangements many of the Commonwealth's wealthy and not-so-wealthy favored had never really appealed to him. Not like Nigel Sheldon with his 1,000 children and dozen-strong harem, or the Kandavu multi-families, or any other of the hundreds of variants on relationships. At heart, he knew he was as old-fashioned as the era he'd come from. Anna, though, was good company, never demanding, happy to keep things comfortably casual. It was almost the same as before the launch, the difference this time being that everyone on board knew about them. It didn't cause any resentment or whispering. They were all grown-ups. Although it had never been a firm policy, one you could find written down or in a program, Wilson had rejected all applications from first lifers. He was convinced they didn't have the temperament he wanted from his crew. The voyage so far had confirmed that in his own mind. There had been so little trouble, so few personality clashes, that he'd begun to regard the ship's psychologist as superfluous. Even now, as he waited on the bridge for the hyperspace flight to end, there was no sign of any tension among those around him. "No significant mass within 100 AUs, Oscar reported. "Thank you," Wilson said. He glanced around at the portals himself, seeing the gravitonic spectrum displays almost blank, like the eye of the storm. They'd obtained their last accurate navigational fix, flying within 300 AUs of a red dwarf, now 10 light-years distant. That put them close to 25 light-years from Dyson Alpha in clear interstellar space. Okay, stand by to take us out of hyperspace. Anna, let's have the main sensor suite online, please.
Aye, sir.
She didn't even grin at him. On the bridge, she took her duties very seriously indeed. Two seats away, Ock tattoos on her hands and forearm began to shimmer like pulsing silver veins as her palms rested on the console icebots, readying the equipment up at the bow of the starship.
Astrophysics? Wilson asked.
Ready, sir.
Tundi Sutton was waiting at the rear of the bridge, along with two of the science officers, Bruno Seymour and Russell Sal. Their consoles all had double the number of portals and screens than the others, capable of displaying a vast amount of data. In addition, all three men had upgraded retinal inserts, giving them a high-quality virtual vision field. If there was any anomaly out there in real space, they'd have it located and analyzed almost instantaneously. They were also sharing the data with the astrophysics office, on the deck above, where the majority of specialists were waiting, including Dudley Bowes.
Oscar, bring the force fields online, please, and take tactical control.
Aye, sir.
Part of Wilson's virtual vision display showed him the power being routed into the force fields and atom lasers. Sensor data was also fed directly into the targeting control, with Oscar assuming executive authority for their missile arsenal. Wilson moved his virtual fingers to activate a general channel throughout the ship.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's see what's out there.
To Lee, take us out of the wormhole, but keep the hyperdrive online. We may need a fast exit.
To Lee grinned broadly.
Yes, sir.
The blue mist filling the two big high-res portals at the front of the bridge began to darken. A ripple of black broke out from the center, expanding rapidly. Clear pinpoints of light speckled the deep night outside the ship as the starfield appeared around them once more.
Tundi, Wilson demanded.
Nothing obvious, sir. Electromagnetic spectrum clean. Gravitonic empty. Standard particle density. Immediate quantum state stable. Zero radar return. Neutrino flux normal. Cosmic radiation high but not excessive.
Sensors. Show me Dyson Alpha, Wilson said.
Anna centered the main telescope, feeding the image to the left-hand portal. Slim red brackets indicated the position of the shielded star. She bled in the infrared emission, and it appeared as a pale pink dot. Dyson Beta materialized slightly to one side.
Doesn't look like there's any change to either of the barriers, she said. They were both still intact 25 years ago.
Any activity in the surrounding area?
Not that I can locate. Do you want a HICE radar sweep?
Not yet. Expand our baseline for the current sensors. I want a clearer picture of the area. Astrophysics, keep monitoring. Pilot, hold us stable here.
Aye, sir.
Anna began to manipulate virtual icons, prepping for sensor module launches. Wilson let out a quick breath of relief. His virtual finger was tapping icons almost unconsciously. On the console in front of him, one of the small screens flicked between camera images. Each one had a small portion of the starship superstructure, the forward sensor array, a slice of the life support wheel, the plasma rockets. But no matter which camera he chose, there was never anything other than the ship and the very distant stars. Nothing. The emptiness was awesome. Frightening.
When he was a boy, Wilson had enjoyed swimming. His parents had a small pool in their yard, and he'd used it every day.
That didn't stop him from continually nagging his parents to take him to the larger pool at the county sports center. He'd been 9 on the day of that visit. He and a whole group of friends ferried out there by some harassed mother. With his skill and confidence, he'd not been intimidated by the size or depth of the big pool, and was soon leading the others through the water. When he was in the deep end, he dived to the bottom, sure he could touch the tiles. He made it easily enough, his strong strokes hauling him down away from the surface, popping his ears against the pressure twice on the way down, before slapping his fingertips on the smooth blue tiles. Sound from the rest of the pool was curiously muted so far below, the thrashing feet above, dull like the filtered blue light. Pressure squeezed him gently,
so he started to swim up. And only then did he realize his mistake. He'd taken enough breath to get him down, but now his lungs were burning. Muscles twitched as the need to suck down fresh air swelled desperately. He began to claw frantically at the water, which did nothing to increase his terrible slow speed. The need for air became overwhelming, and his chest began to expand, lungs working to pull in that sweet oxygen. Wilson felt the water sliding up his nostrils like some unstoppable, burrowing creature. Right that second, he knew if it got any farther, he would drown. It was enough to send his body into a frenzy, kicking and struggling. At the same time, he found the discipline to stop his lungs from trying to inhale. Somehow he managed to break the surface without the water spilling any farther inside him. Only then did he suck down a huge breath of beautiful, clean air, almost sobbing as the shock of what had happened struck him. For a long time he'd clung to the side of the pool as big shivers ran up and down his body. Finally, he regained enough control to swim back out to his friends. Even during his Air Force combat flights, he'd never felt so scared as that whimpering child striking out for the side of the pool. Nothing had ever come close to recreating that feeling. Until now. Now that same clammy sickness was gripping him just like it had his 9-year-old self, as the reality sank in of how far away from anything they were. He started his ancient deep breathing exercise routine, trying to calm his body before the shakes started. "Modules disengaging," Anna announced.
"Right. Thank you,"
Wilson replied a little too abruptly. His virtual hand stopped flicking through the camera sequence, and he concentrated hard on the images of the sensor modules. Something to do, something to shift his mind off the nothingness of outside. He felt his heart rate slow as he forced his breathing to a regular rhythm, though there was nothing he could do about the cold perspiration on his forehead. A text-only message popped up into his virtual vision. It was from Anna and read, "Are you all right?" "Fine," he sent back. He didn't look in her direction. Everyone else on the bridge seemed to be absorbed by their work, unaffected by what lay outside. He was the only one interstellar space was intimidating. That piqued him somewhat, enough to make him focus properly on his job. The screen on his console showed him the forward section of the Second Chance. Doors on 8 cylindrical bays had opened up, spaced equidistantly just behind the bow's large sensor cluster. Modules like big metallized insects, sprouting golden antennae, were drifting out, glittering in the lights around the rim of each bay. Ion thrusters flared blue on the base of each one, pushing them away from the starship. They traveled in an expanding circle, linked by laser and microwave, taking hours to reach their standoff station. When they were 50,000 kilometers out, their ion thrusters burned again, bringing them to a halt. As one, their dark protective segments peeled open, exposing delicate sensor instruments to the interstellar medium. Discs, blocks, booms, and lenses uncoiled on the end of electromuscle tentacles and began scanning space around Dyson Alpha. The big arrays back on the Second Chance correlated the results, combining them into a single image with extraordinarily high resolution in every spectrum. For everyone waiting eagerly on board, the result was a big disappointment. Virtually no new information about the barrier was revealed. Its diameter was confirmed at 29.7 AUs. There was a moment of prayer-like silence on the bridge as that fact was absorbed. The surface was emitting in a very low infrared wavelength. Local particle density was slightly lower than average, indicating that solar wind emission from Dyson A and B was blocked. Nothing else could be detected. After 5 days of cautious observation for any sign of hostile events, or any other energy emission that might point to artificially generated activity, Wilson had to agree with his science team that there was no obvious danger at this distance. He ordered the sensor expansion modules back to the starship, and they flew 15 light-years closer. When they emerged into real space again, they repeated the examination. From 5 light-years, the images that expanded baseline modules provided were even more exact. But nothing had changed.
The interstellar particle winds blowing off nearby stars were detectable as they gusted around the barrier, creating giant swirls and eddies that sighed in the electromagnetic spectrum like faint whale song. Wilson moved them forward in one light-year increments. Each time the 8 modules would fly out and peer ahead. Each time they would provide a more detailed survey of the local radiation and particle environment. Of the barrier itself, they revealed nothing.
"Take us to one light month out," Wilson told Tu Li.
"Aye, sir."
"Tunde, that'll take us within high-definition range of the HICE radar," Wilson said. "Do we scan it?"
The astrophysicist gave an expansive shrug from behind his bridge console. "It'll tell us a lot about the nature of the barrier, but then we'll probably reveal ourselves. If there is an active force controlling it, I can't imagine they won't be able to detect it."
Oscar looked at the forward portals that showed the blue walls of the wormhole closing over real space.
"They have to know already. We'd be able to pick up the quantum signature of a wormhole from this distance."
"The builders must have realized that people would come and investigate at some point," Anna said. "You can't do something like this and expect it to go unnoticed."
"We'll run passive scans first," Wilson said. "If there's no response, we can use the HICE radar."
Just under 4 hours later, the second chance emerged from hyperspace. Wilson didn't have to order the expanded baseline modules out. The ship's main telescope revealed the full expanse of the disk. In infrared, it was like the baleful eye of some dreaming dragon.
"Very low neutrino density out here, and virtually nothing coming from Dyson Alpha's direction," Bruno Seymour said. "I'd say the barrier is impermeable to them. We should be picking up the whole deluge from the star at this distance."
"What about particle density?" Wilson asked.
"Interstellar wash, that's all. No particle wind from the star itself. The barrier must be converting all the energy hitting its internal surface to infrared. Output corresponds to that, assuming the star remains the same inside."
"Thank you," Wilson said. He was staring at the red circle, all sense of isolation long gone.
"Is it solid?"
"No, sir," Tandy Sutton said. "We're picking up the star's gravity field. It's weak but detectable. If that thing was solid, it would mass at least the same as an average star. Probably a lot more."
"So it blocks neutrinos, elementary particles, and most of the electromagnetic spectrum, but not gravity. Are any of our force fields like that?"
"Similar," Tandy said. "I'm sure we can build a generator that duplicates those properties. It wouldn't be easy."
"And what would it take to power one this size?"
Tandy almost flinched. Bruno and Russell grinned at his discomfort.
"A good percentage of the star's fusion energy." "Can you tell if that's missing?"
"Not really. We'd need a much better measurement of the naked star to compare with. We've never had that."
"Okay. If you can pick up the star's gravity field, can you tell if there are any planets orbiting inside?"
"Not from out here. We need to get closer for that."
"Anna, is there any sign of activity outside the barrier? Anything at all?"
"No, sir, nothing. No microwave communications, no laser, no radar emission. No plasma trails, not even a chemical rocket plume as far as we can see, though we're stretching resolution on that one. No wormhole signatures either. As far as our sensors are concerned, we're alone out here."
Wilson gave Oscar a glance. "It's beginning to look like a relic," the exec said. He sounded disappointed.
"All right. Give it a HICE radar sweep. And I want a very careful watch for any response. Hyperdrive, be ready to take us straight out of here."
"Yes, sir."
The bridge was silent for a couple of minutes as Anna and Tu Li worked in tandem, sending out hyper-accelerated gravity waves from the wormhole generator.
"Unusual," Tandy Sutton said eventually. "It simply reflected the pulses back at us like a mirror. That indicates a very complex quantum structure. But then we knew it was never going to be anything simple."
"Did we ring any bells?" Wilson asked.
Anna and the astrophysics team shook their heads. "Still no sign of activity. But we are limited with sensors from this range. Anything in the electromagnetic spectrum is going to take a month to show up."
"I'm more concerned about hyperspace and quantum field activity."
"Nothing so far."
"Very well.
Oscar.
We've come a long way, Oscar said, and so far we've seen nothing to make us turn back.
I agree. Prepare the ship for a hostile encounter scenario. Hyperspace, take us in to 1,000,000 kilometers above the barrier's equator.
Aye, sir.
The wormhole projected into real space with a burst of Cherenkov radiation, its toroidal nimbus twinkling with azure scintillations. It dissipated as quickly as it had begun, leaving the second chance floating 1,000,000 kilometers above the blank surface of the barrier. On such a scale, there was no visible curvature to the shell around the star. It appeared as a simple flat plane extending to infinity in every direction, as if the starship had reached the bottom of the universe.
We couldn't have gone through, Thule reported, as soon as they were established in real space.
What do you mean? Wilson asked.
The barrier is a block to wormholes as well. There was a lot of exotic energy echo as we approached.
Whatever the barrier is, it extends through the quantum fields. The wormhole wouldn't be able to circumvent it.
So there really is no way in, Wilson mused.
Or out, Oscar said.
Wilson turned to the astrophysicists.
So how can the star's gravity field get through?
We'll let you know, Tandy said. He didn't sound happy. Heiss radar sweep gives a shear surface, Anna said. Definitely no neutrino penetration. I've never seen the detectors registering this low before.
How thick is it?
That dimension really only applies to solid matter, Tandy said. This is an artificial rift in the quantum fields which manifests itself in space-time. Technically, it has no physical depth. It's two-dimensional.
Fine.
Wilson couldn't take his attention off the standard radar return.
Any sign of spacecraft activity?
Nothing, Anna said. She sounded slightly peeved at having to churn out constant reassurance. No rocket exhausts, no wormhole signatures. There's nobody else here.
I'd qualify that, Tandy said. This goddamn thing is 30 AUs across.
That's almost impossible for the human mind to grasp. We're not even seeing a fraction of a percent from here.
There could be a battle fleet of ships the size of a moon gathered 5 AUs away, and we'd never know.
Let's not get carried away, Wilson said. This is what we're here for, people. A full survey and analysis. So, pilot, hold us steady at this standoff distance. Defense, keep our shields up until further notice. Hyperdrive, keep us ready for an immediate exit. Astrophysics, you're on. I want a comprehensive sensor sweep from this distance. Probe it with everything we've got. We are not getting any closer for now. If you can confirm there are no active components which threaten us, I'll authorize a remote satellite examination of the barrier's structure. Until then, we play it safe.
He leaned back in the chair and watched as the data started to build up on his screen and within his virtual vision. The stream of results was unending and growing by the hour, as new instruments were unsheathed and applied. Only a fraction of the information made any sense to him. It was slightly humbling. He'd always thought himself quite up to date on physics. Tandy Sutton and the rest of the science crew tore into the raw data with unnerving enthusiasm. Their attitude was childlike in its wonder. Wilson was very careful not to intrude or censure Tandy for the way he ran his department, but from what he could see, they were acting more like first-life science geeks than the wise, considered professors they'd been when selected. They quarreled and laughed among themselves, completely uncaring for social restraint. Suddenly, after all these months, they were now the elite, aloof from the rest of the crew. It showed. Wilson overstayed his duty period by 2 hours, then turned the bridge over to Oscar. An hour later, Anna found him in the forward observation gallery. It was a long, dark compartment on the wheel's middle deck, with subdued blue floor lighting. She paused for a long moment after she came through the door, letting her eyes acclimatize to the darkness. The gallery had 3 tall windows of optically perfect glass facing forward. The silhouettes of several people were just visible. The barrier was a popular vista. She walked over to Wilson.
Hi,
she whispered.
Hi.
His hand found hers in the gloom, fingers fumbling. They stood together, content with their closeness.
Anna could see the main cylinder above them, a somber grey bulk illuminated by the small nav lights dotting its surface. It was rotating slowly, turning various sensor clumps into view, one after the other.
"I'm not sure if I can see it," Wilson murmured quietly. "My inserts give me a perfect image in infrared. But when I cancel that, I think I can see it. If it's there, it's like a fat cloud of the darkest red ever. Maybe I'm just imagining it, because I know that's what it should look like, and it looks as if it's just in front of my nose."
"On this scale, it is," she whispered back. "We're not even a germ to a basketball."
"Can you see it?"
"I don't know." Stupid though the action was, she leaned forward slightly, squinting.
Her inserts were off now, and there might well have been some kind of ultra-dark vermilion haze out there in front of the nose, the kind of luminosity you got from a single candle lighting a cathedral.
"It's like a ghost light."
"Hmm. I always thought I had quite good eyes. I'll have to get them resequenced next time I go into rejuve."
He waved his hand in front of his face to see if that made any difference, if he could see the outline of his fingers against the obscure emission. There was too much secondary lighting in the observation gallery to be certain.
"Whether I can see it or not, I can certainly feel it. The damn thing's spooky, like something lurking just outside your thoughts."
She curled her arm around his.
"Come on.
It's been a long day. Time you got some rest."
He grinned. His teeth were just visible in the gloaming. "I'm too tired and strung out to argue."
He allowed himself to be led toward the door.
"Strung out? You?" "Yeah. We spent a year getting this ship built. I spent 300 years waiting for something this important to happen to me again. I wanted something there when we came out of hyperdrive. Something positive that I could see and understand. When we sat down on Mars, there was all this alien geology surrounding me. It was strange and even beautiful after a fashion, and nobody really knew anything about it. But you could break open a rock with a hammer and see the minerals and strata inside. We had a knowledge base that could take that information and pin down what kind of rock it was, what event produced it. It was all in my head, information I could apply."
They were alone in the corridor, so she stood on her toes and kissed him.
"You poor old thing."
Wilson smiled, sheepish now.
"Yeah, well, I guess I'm just intimidated, that's all. The size of this fucker is mind-warping. I really shouldn't let it get to me."
"I know. Whacking this with a hammer isn't going to help."
"No." He kissed her back. "I bet it would make me feel a hell of a lot better, though."
5 days later, Wilson allowed the second chance to move up to 50,000 kilometers above the barrier. They used the plasma rockets, accelerating in at a 50th of a G, then stopped and flipped over to decelerate. The physicists were very keen to see what would happen when the exhaust sprayed against the surface. The simple answer was nothing. Satellites, hovering centimeters above the barrier, observed the residue of gas and energized particles strike the surface and rebound. There was no heat or momentum transfer. No effect. Gigabytes flowed back up the microwave links between satellites and Starship, expanding the already vast database on the barrier. A huge quantity of sensor log files were stored in the RI array, almost all of them containing negative information. Every member of the science crew could tell Wilson what it wasn't. They could explain its properties at great length. What nobody could tell him was how it was generated, nor from where. And they certainly didn't know why it existed. But then, he told Anna charitably one night, they had only been there for 5 days. He shouldn't expect miracles. The Starship hung above the stubborn barrier for another 8 days, picking at it with various beams of radiation, like a small child with an intriguing scab, eager to see what lay beneath. Their wormhole generator distorted space-time in many convoluted perturbations, the wave function of each one bouncing off the near-invisible surface without any significant resonance pattern. During that time, their only major discovery was the planets inside the barrier. Tundi confirmed that gravitational readings showed 2 gas giants and 3 small solid planets were orbiting the star,
with indications of several large asteroids. It livened up the daily department head's meeting when he told them that one of the solid worlds was within the life band, the distance from the star that would allow carbon-based life to evolve, should the planetary conditions be favorable, such as the availability of water and a decent atmospheric pressure. Finally, for morale's sake rather than practical science, Wilson allowed McLean Gilbert to fly out to the surface. After the long, boring flight, the crew was becoming restless. Like Wilson, they'd all expected something a little more substantial, some hint as to the origin of the barrier, the reason behind it. One of their own actually going out there and examining it in person should help alleviate some of the tension that was building up in the life support wheel. So the whole starship was watching as the small shuttle flew out of its hangar in the cylindrical superstructure. It was a simple spherical life support capsule capable of transporting up to 15 passengers, sitting on top of a drum-shaped propulsion section containing the environmental equipment and two small plasma rockets. A short-range vehicle, with a 10-day flight margin, it was intended to ferry science officers between any items of interest to be found at the Dyson Pair. Although it didn't have an atmospheric entry ability, it could set down on small airless moons, or more hopefully rendezvous with alien starships, alien space stations, or if they were really lucky, even a barrier generator. Nearly everybody on board had volunteered to accompany Mac, including a very vocal Dudley Bowes. But Wilson had vetoed any passengers on this trip. Mac had a backup exploration team member, a pilot, and an engineer riding with him. But that was all. The shuttle used its tiny chemical reaction control engines to hold station 100 meters away from the barrier, and Mac wriggled his way carefully out of the craft's cylindrical airlock. His spacesuit's inner ply-plastic layer gripped his skin, constantly adjusting to accommodate his every movement, yet always fitting snugly. On top of that, he wore a thermal regulator garment, woven out of heat duct fibers, which would carry away any excess body heat. Above that was a thicker suit, a pale gray in color, combining a radiation baffle cloth and an external impact armor layer, resistant to most micrometeor strikes. It had a built-in force field generator web, which was his real protection in space. If that failed, then procedure was to abandon the EVA and head for the nearest airlock. His helmet was a reinforced transparent bubble, also radiation-proof and temperature-resistant, which he could opaque depending on the light level, giving him all-around visibility, which was boosted by various color sensors he could access through his virtual vision. Batteries, the heat regulator, and the air regenerator system were all contained in a neat little pack built into the front of the outer suit, with a couple of circular radiator fins to discard surplus body heat. The whole thing was interfaced and controlled via his e-butler, with its system schematic icons sprinkled around his virtual vision. As soon as he was clear of the airlock hatch rim, he anchored himself to the fuselage grid. The cilia on his boot soles adhered to the lattice with a grip strong enough to hold him in place against the kind of torque his body might apply by mistake in the confusion of freefall. He bent over, his stomach muscles pulling hard in the absence of gravity, and unfastened the maneuvering pack from its storage rack. It was a simple unit, a slim backpack with fat plastic mushrooms on each corner, sprouting cold gas nozzles that could jet him about freely over a range of several kilometers. As he was strapping it on, a new set of icons appeared in his virtual vision. He made sure the diagnostic software ran a full check before his virtual hand began to manipulate the joystick. Now he was actually out here, with so many of his crewmates watching over his shoulder, it was tempting to twist the throttle and scoot over to the barrier right away. But he forced himself to get through the physical test routine, burping all the cold gas nozzles, confirming their thrust. Only when his little practice flight around the shuttle was complete did he say, "Ready for crossing."
"You look good from here," Oscar said. "Telemetry at 100%. Clear to proceed."
That familiar voice, with its perpetual tone of dry amusement, was one Mac found absurdly reassuring. In this awesomely bizarre situation, it was a welcome touch of normality, the same voice that had led him out onto a dozen new worlds. Virtual fingers tilted the joystick forward, and the maneuvering pack nozzles snorted nitrogen, moving him out away from the shuttle. As far as he could see in the standard visual spectrum, he was heading into total darkness. The barrier could be a couple of centimeters in front of him, or 50 light-years. His radar said 93 meters. He bumped the speed up to a couple of meters per second, then told his e-butler to switch on the craft's spotlights. His spacesuit glowed a dusky pewter as the beams followed him. Up ahead, he was sure he could see the triple circles where they were striking the barrier. They formed a royal blue patch. The effect was almost as if someone was rendering a cartoon shimmer on the surface. Mac activated the infrared function in his retinal inserts. Half of the universe turned a lambent carmine. Even though he could see the barrier, there was still no way to judge physical distance. The radar put him 40 meters out. He began to reduce his closing speed, and the spotlights were showing up as circles with a slightly greenish tint, but he could finally see his own shadow projected onto the flat wall ahead. He came to a halt a meter away, and just floated there for a moment. The biomonitor showed him his racing heartbeat, and he could hear the adrenaline buzz in his ears. He started to raise his arm, fingers extending to touch the enigmatic surface, then paused. He hadn't received permission, but if he checked before doing anything, the EVA would take all day. The reason he'd been chosen was because of his contact experience. Not in this situation, he told himself evilly, and managed a small grin. His heart rate had slowed a little now, so he completed the motion. His fingers touched the surface. For one twisted-up moment, he imagined the barrier vanishing like a soap bubble, punctured by his ignorant touch. But it didn't, and he chuckled slightly at the notion. By now he was drifting away, propelled by the slight contact, so he moved the joystick forward and put his hand out again. This time the maneuvering pack held him in place. Okay, I'm touching it. No apparent reaction. Seems like ordinary solid matter. There's none of that slight surface instability you get on our force fields.
Understood, Mac, Oscar said. We were all waiting for some demonic claw to come through and drag you in.
Hey, thanks for that.
My pleasure. You feel like applying some sensors for us?
Will do. He reached down to the equipment clipped on his belt. One by one, he stuck sensor pads against the barrier, taking measurements. He had to hold each one in place. The high-temperature epoxy was no use at all. When he squeezed it out of the tube, it simply rebounded off the barrier like water splashing off Teflon.
We didn't think that would work, Oscar said. There aren't any atoms there for it to adhere to. Worth a try, though.
Sure, but I'm using up gas at quite a rate keeping these sensors applied.
Copy that. Please apply the meson rate detector.
Okay. He settled the fat little cylinder against the surface. Once again, that notion of there being something on the other side was strong in his mind. He was scratching away on the barrier like some mouse behind the baseboard, and the house cat was listening intently, unseen, just the thickness of an electron away. Irrational, he kept telling himself, but surely something knows we're here. He twisted his head to one side until he could see the starfield. For a moment he was upright, pressed against a wall, with the night sky behind him, the ground lost beneath his feet. The vertical horizon between red and black was perfectly straight and clear. When he looked down, that same horizon was below his boots. A human mind simply couldn't grasp the size of the thing. Whoever established this incredible artifact must have had a phenomenally compelling reason. Defense? Confinement? The sweepstake on board was running 80-20. Both implied aggression somewhere. Again, on a scale beyond human comprehension.
You all right there, Mac? Oscar asked.
He realized his heart was thudding again and took a couple of deep breaths.
Sure, no problem.
What's next?
Exotic waveform detector. Tandy wants to know exactly where the infrared emission originates. That should help define the barrier interface with space-time.
Sure. After 40 minutes, he placed the last sensor back on his belt and jetted back to the shuttle. The physicists were pleased with the results. They had moved another step toward understanding the nature of the barrier. But as to how it was generated, and the why of it, they hadn't got a clue.
2 days after Mac's EVA, the morning departmental heads meeting decided that information gathering had progressed about as far as it could from a static observation point. Wilson was concerned that they weren't making enough progress in other directions.
"We were sent here to establish the reason why the barrier was erected," he told them somewhat formally, after they'd had the usual roundup of results from the previous day. "Tunde, I know your teams are doing a great job on the characteristics of the barrier, but we need more than that. Now you're identifying its quantum structure. Is there any way we can reformat the hyperdrive to get us past?"
"No," Tunde said. "In fact, I don't think there is a way through.
We might not be able to generate a barrier like this for ourselves, but we do understand enough about its properties to just about rule out any kind of circumvention through hyperspace. A wormhole simply cannot be opened through it."
"What about forcing our way in?" Oscar asked. "Can we break through in real space?"
"Again, no. Absolutely not.
Even if you could generate collapsed state energy levels and apply them directly against the barrier, it wouldn't have any effect. It's not physical. It can't be damaged or stressed in the way solid matter can. One day we might be able to manipulate quantum fields in such a way to destabilize a section, but that won't be for a long time. To use a very bad pun, we haven't even scratched the surface."
"Then we must look for clues elsewhere," Wilson said. "Admittedly, given the size we're dealing with here, that can only be the most perfunctory search, but it must be done. We're back to our original two theories, offensive or defensive. If the barrier is defensive, there may be signs of the attacking force left somewhere outside."
"Signs, or the whole armada?" Oscar asked lightly.
"If they were here, they'd be investigating us by now," said Antonia Clark, the engineering chief. "We've created enough disturbance since we've arrived. Even a few perfunctory warning satellites scattered around the barrier would have found us."
"Maybe," Tunde said, "but we certainly haven't located any active observation equipment. And it is a long time since the barrier went up. The threat might not exist anymore."
"It's only long on a human scale," Oscar said.
"All right." Wilson held up his hands to prevent any full-scale argument erupting. "If the attacking force or entity is still here, we need to find it, preferably without it seeing us, which I admit is a long shot. However, we have to try. If they've gone, then they might have left something behind. And if the barrier was put up for the opposite reason, to confine the star and its inhabitants, then we have an even greater chance of finding the builders. Therefore, I have decided we'll take the second chance on a complete circumnavigation of the equator. We'll stand off an AU and use the hyperdrive at low speed. If we take a week, the HICE radar will be able to complete a very accurate scan of the surrounding space. Following that, and taking the worst-case scenario that we find nothing, we'll fly to both poles and examine them. If after that we still draw blank, we'll review the situation then."
"Captain," Tunde said, "I'd like to raise the issue of communication."
"With whom?"
"Both our scenarios imply that there is some kind of sentient life to be found inside the barrier. Now that we're this close, it may be possible to attract their attention, possibly even initiate a dialogue."
"How? I thought you said the barrier was impervious."
"It is to everything except gravity," he indicated the chief engineer. "I've discussed this with Antonia. It shouldn't be too difficult to modify the energy configuration of the hyperdrive to create simple gravity waves. If the civilization inside has a working gravity detector, they should be able to pick it up."
The notion surprised Wilson. Given the analysis he'd been getting from the science teams since they'd arrived, he'd dismissed the notion of any attempted contact a long time ago.
"How difficult would the adaptations be? I will not authorize taking the hyperdrive offline at any time."
"It's a matter of programming," Antonia said. "That's all. Standard gravity wave emission would be a simple modification of the HICE radar function. The ship's RI can give us a reformatted routine within a couple of hours."
"Okay, then. You can go ahead with the program."
If the circumnavigation flight doesn't produce any results, we'll certainly try it. Good idea, both of you. It was the second day of their week-long flight around the equator when the HICE radar finally found something of interest. The first scan returns came back just after midnight, ship's time. Oscar was in command on the bridge. He ordered the second chance back into normal space and put a call in to the captain's cabin. By the time Wilson arrived, pulling on his jacket and shaking his head to rid himself of sleep, the starship's main sensors were fully deployed. A picture was building up on the bridge portals. He squinted at it, not quite believing what he was seeing. The radar graphic of neon green grid lines was the most detailed, showing a perfect hemisphere rising out of the barrier. Its base was 25,000 kilometers in diameter. Tundi Sutton and Bruno Seymour arrived on the bridge. Both of them stood behind Wilson, staring in perplexity.
"Wow," Bruno muttered. "Talk about a flying amber."
"Okay," Wilson went over and sat behind his console. "What am I looking at? Is that a planet?" "No, sir," Russell said. The screens on his console were shimmering with light as he ran the incoming data through analysis routines. "I'd say it's some kind of extension of the barrier itself. Surface is uniformly smooth, just like the barrier, and it is a perfect hemisphere as well. It has an extremely strong magnetic field, at least an order of magnitude above a standard planetary field, and it's fluctuating wildly, almost as if it's spinning. There's no gravity field as such. Sensors are picking up gravity wave emissions, though. They're regular pulses of some kind, not synchronized with the magnetic shift, though. Very odd." At that, Wilson turned to face Tundi, who was just sitting down behind his own console. The astrophysicist gave him a confused frown.
"A signal?" Wilson asked.
"I don't know. The pulse sequence hasn't varied," Russell said. "If it's a signal, it's not saying much.
Can you see where they're coming from?"
"They seem to be from within the hemisphere, although the actual origin point appears to be moving around in there."
"Okay. Anything else?"
"There's no infrared emission." He nodded at the large portal. It was showing the barrier's blank surface in bright carmine. A large circle in the center of the image was black, as if a hole had been cut through.
"Wait, there's something at the top."
Russell's voice rose in pitch as he interpreted the raw data.
"The apex isn't curved, it's flat, or maybe some kind of crater. An opening. There's an opening there."
"You're right," Bruno called out. There was a wild grin on his face. "Slight photon emission. There's light shining out, wavelength just outside ultraviolet. It's not infrared, not like the rest of the barrier. That could be the way in."
Wilson and Oscar exchanged a shocked glance.
"Calm down," Wilson said. "I want realities, not speculation at this point. Give me a decent image from the main telescope. Oscar, what's our current standoff distance?"
100,000 kilometers above the barrier, 70,000 from the hemisphere."
"Good enough. Focusing now," Bruno announced.
The bridge portal showed a fast expanding ring of red flashing outward. Then it was completely black.
"Here it comes," Bruno said triumphantly,
a speck of luminescence getting bigger rapidly, jumping up to a crescent of lavender light that shivered in the middle of the portal.
"Size?" Wilson asked. "The hole is 17 kilometers across."
"This wavelength doesn't match Dyson Alpha's known spectrum," Tundi said. "That's not the star shining out."
Wilson couldn't take his gaze off the sliver of light.
"Any local activity that would indicate spacecraft or sensors?"
"No, sir."
"I don't suppose you know if that hole was open when we emerged from the wormhole?"
"We know the apex was flat, but the HICE radar return doesn't tell us if it was open."
"Very well. Recommendations."
"Send a probe in," Russell said immediately.
"Eventually, yes," Tundi said. "But we'll need to observe it for a while first."
"While we're doing that, we could send a satellite on a flyby above the opening," Oscar said. "Keep it at our current standoff distance, and take a look directly down inside. Our position gives us a lousy angle of view."
Wilson was mildly surprised at the suggestion. He'd expected Oscar to be more cautious, although a satellite flyby was reasonable enough.
If anything was in there, they must surely be aware of the second chance.
Go ahead. I'll start the prep sequence.
Oscar went over to the console Anna normally used and called up the launch sequence.
In the meantime, Wilson said dryly, does anyone have any ideas about what this thing is?
Jean Duvoir chuckled softly.
Fortress of Darkness, where the evil lord hangs out.
Thanks. Anyone else?
I have a possibility, Bruno said.
He was close to blushing as the bridge crew all looked at him.
Well, it's active, right? Something inside is generating gravity waves and magnetic fields. And that's just what we can detect. It's also absolutely right on the equator. And as near as our senses can tell, it's perfectly aligned with the plane of the ecliptic, though I'm not sure how relevant that is.
He glanced around, unnerved by the attention.
I just thought it might be a generator, that's all, where the whole barrier is being produced from, or at least this area of it.
Wilson looked at Tundi and raised an eyebrow in query.
Gets my vote, Tundi said, until something else comes along to disprove it.
He gave Bruno a thumbs up.
Smart.
Oscar launched the Moore-class satellite 20 minutes later. Its ion drive accelerated it away from the big starship, sending it curving over the apex of the dark hemisphere. Nearly every screen on board relayed the image from its visual spectrum cameras. The violet glow didn't reveal much.
Certainly there was nothing lurking just inside.
A very detailed analysis program picked up a slight but regular fluctuation to the output intensity. It didn't match the oscillations of either the gravity waves or magnetic field. 4 hours after leaving Second Chance, the satellite was directly above the opening. Even on the highest magnification, it could see nothing but the homogeneous dark blue glow, as if the hemisphere contained nothing but a fluorescent fog. 20 minutes later, when half of the crew had lost interest, the light vanished, leaving the opening completely dark. 18 minutes later, it reappeared. Intensive slow-motion replays, coupled with image-enhancing programs, showed that something had moved across the opening, cutting off the light.
Your evil lord just blinked, Oscar told Jean.
After 3 days of observation, they knew the light was blocked on average every 7.25 hours, though this could vary by up to 8 minutes. The eclipse duration was more constant, lasting a fraction over 18 minutes, except once when it had gone on for nearly 35. As nothing had come out of the hole in all that time, Wilson finally authorized a close observation. A large Galileo-class satellite had left its launch bay on the Second Chance, equipped with a more expansive sensor suite than the Moore. Anna slowed its approach as it closed in on the hole, keeping it 20 kilometers above the hemisphere's perfectly black surface. Telemetry showed her the little craft was taking a beating on the magnetic and electromagnetic wave fronts. Even with circuitry hardened to withstand the kind of treacherous energy environment found around the most active gas giants, she had to watch out for overloads and temporary glitches. Interference caused a lot of static within the data stream link back to the starship, resulting in poor imagery and broken instrument readings. Everyone on board the starship watched as the hull slowly slipped into view, its gentle lavender radiance appearing like the dawn of a weak sun. It was an illusion that was broken soon enough as the satellite crept closer. The illuminated hull was small by any standards. Then the satellite passed over the rim, slowing to a relative halt. The magnetic flux, in tandem with the gravity waves, was strong enough to induce a detectable wobble, as if the satellite was floating on a sea. Anna did her best to counter the tiny vibrations, allowing the sensors to peer down carefully. 400 kilometers below the hole, a curved lattice of immense dark strands was gliding slowly across the blue glow that came from deeper inside. As the satellite focused on the strands, it became clear that the lattice was anything but a uniform hexagonal honeycomb. The interstices ranged from simple triangles up to 12-sided grids, with some of the strands curving them into near ellipsoid geometries. The holes were the size of small countries, with strands up to a couple of 100 kilometers wide. One thing was obvious from the curvature and ponderous motion. The lattice was a sphere.
1,000 kilometers beneath it, a second lattice sphere was visible, also composed of dark strands, though this one had a more regular geography, mostly comprised of triangles and pentagons. It, too, was rotating, but in a completely different direction to the outer layer. And below that was a third lattice grid, with wider spacings. Its continent-long strands glowed a strong indigo, helping to create the pervasive glow. Its radiance was complemented to a large degree by streaks of amethyst light that came from underneath it, the indicators of a fourth lattice sphere spinning somewhere in the deeps. Exactly where was unclear. The third lattice appeared to be surrounded by some kind of lambent vapor.
"Son of a bitch," Wilson whispered.
Out of all the things he'd expected to see within the Dark Fortress, a kinetic sculpture bigger than planets was not high on the list. The scale of the barrier was already hammering at his beleaguered human senses, but that at least had been a projection, energy manipulated and folded on a stellar scale, while these lattice spheres looked resolutely solid. This was matter manipulated in quantities incomprehensible to Commonwealth technology. Yet the barrier creators had produced something that, from a simple visual viewpoint, was almost laughably mechanical, in the truest sense of the word. He wouldn't be at all surprised now if they were to find gearboxes with cogwheels the size of moons driving the entire edifice.
"Are those strands really solid?"
he asked. "I can't tell," Anna said. "The electromagnetic environment in there is playing hell with the satellite's radar."
"That much matter would coalesce under its own gravity," Bruno said. "They have to be energy forms."
"Not so," Russell immediately claimed. "There's nothing like a terrestrial planet mass in there. And their spin rates will keep them inflated."
"Nonsense. They'd have to be metallic hydrogen to maintain their structural integrity under these conditions."
"So, it's metallic hydrogen. Apart from those glowing ones, I'd say they were exotic matter. There's virtually no infrared emission coming from in there."
"Is the outer shell complete?" Oscar asked. "I mean, is there a corresponding hemisphere on the inside of the barrier? Or is this just some giant bearing groove for those lattice spheres?"
"Good question," Tundi said. "Anna, can you focus the satellite telescope through those grids?" "No, sir. No way," she exclaimed. "That haze effect around the third sphere is like looking into a gas giant cloudscape, and it gets thicker below it."
"Like oil," Oscar muttered. "It lubricates the gaps between the spheres."
He realized Tundi was looking at him and smiled an apology.
"Just a thought."
"Anna," Wilson asked, "will the satellite survive in there?" She let out a long breath as she stared at the main image on the twin portals. "I don't see why not. Certainly as far down as the first lattice sphere, anyway. The sensor returns we've got show clear space that far in."
"Okay, then," Wilson said slowly, as a sense of real enthusiasm grew inside him. "Let's do it."
Anna launched a second Galileo-class satellite, flying it to the entrance hole at the top of what the crew now all called the Dark Fortress. Once it arrived, she sent the first satellite inside, using the second as a relay. As it descended toward the outermost lattice sphere, the energy surges around the satellite picked up noticeably. Eventually, Anna stopped trying to compensate. At that rate, she would run out of fuel in a matter of hours, so she let the little craft wobble its way forward, blurring the visual sensor pictures. Every 80 kilometers or so, she would stabilize it again and run a quick check before allowing the vibrations to build up. There was nothing to see en route. The gap between the outer shell and the first grid sphere was empty, with the satellite sensors recording it as a hard vacuum. When it was halfway there, one of the sphere's massive struts slid underneath the hole, eclipsing the light pouring up from the inner lattice spheres. By now the crew were successfully recording the geography of the first lattice and were making good progress charting the second. There seemed to be no logic behind the pattern, but predicting the times of the eclipses was now straightforward. As the satellite grew nearer to the first lattice sphere, the radar return began to improve.
"That's odd," Anna remarked as she stabilized the satellite once again.
"Problem?" Tundi asked.
I'm using parallax to confirm the distance to the strut we're heading for, but there's a discrepancy between that and the radar return. Radar places it 3 clicks closer. Maybe that optical haze effect is throwing the parallax reading?
She shook her head. Clear view.
There is no haze around these struts.
The discrepancy began to rise as the satellite closed in. Then they examined the magnetic flux around the strut, seeing the force lines warp like cyclone clouds around the surface. After a long and heated conference with the rest of the physics team, Tundi said, "Whatever else it is, the outer lattice sphere has electro-repulsive properties. The radar pulses aren't actually reaching the surface itself."
"Can we take the satellite in and attempt a landing?" Wilson asked.
"I wouldn't recommend it. That repulsion force would play havoc with the electronics. We'll have to study it from a distance."
The Galileo satellite spent 2 days hovering 30 kilometers above the first lattice sphere as it rotated slowly underneath. All of its sensors' booms were fully extended, gathering up as much information as possible. Back on the starship, the physics team worked with the engineers to try to design a simple probe that they could drop onto one of the struts. Its circuitry was all optronic, using a laser for communication. Sensors were extremely limited, but even studying its flight path as it neared a strut would tell them something. Wilson, keen to expand the exploration of the Dark Fortress, authorized its deployment. A further 2 Galileo-class satellites were launched. Anna and Jean Duvoir had assembled a small team of controllers drawn from the pilot qualified on board to help remote fly the probes. Together they steered the twin satellites through the entrance hole and took them down toward the first lattice sphere. Anna maneuvered the lead one into the center of a pentagonal-shaped grid, and while Jean held the original satellite 50 kilometers above as a communications booster, she fired its ion thrusters, flying it straight in toward the second lattice sphere. As it passed through the level of the struts, electronic systems suffered repeated crashes. Thankfully, the multiple redundancy architecture managed to keep the primary components online the whole time, constantly rebooting the failed units. It released the probe and carried on. Once it fell below the outermost lattice sphere, the Galileo returned to full functionality. Heartened by that, Anna got another of her team to send the second satellite through. With both of them clear and operational, she took them in deeper still. The probe, meanwhile, drifted steadily toward its target strut. Information zipped back along the laser link, revealing the swirling energy environment around the vast mass. Contact was lost a couple of minutes before impact. The physics team wrote that down to the repulsion force affecting the probe's battery. Anna's team piloted the 2 Galileo satellites in toward the second lattice sphere. As they receded from the first, so the magnetic and electromagnetic squalls shrank away. It began to look as though the second lattice sphere was inert. With one satellite holding back, poised halfway between the two, Anna lowered hers in toward the edge of a strut making up a large pentagon shape. Radar return was precise. There was no magnetic field, no electromagnetic emission. The infrared signature was minute. "Something's slowing it," Anna reported. The satellite's velocity was dropping at an increasing rate, as though it were encountering some kind of atmosphere. Molecular sensors stubbornly continued to report a vacuum outside. Anna managed to get it within 70 kilometers of a strut surface before it came to a complete halt. She had to fire the main thrusters at full strength simply to keep it there. Without that, the satellite would have reversed its trajectory. "Something's pushing it away," she told the physics team. After 3 days of attempted approaches at varying velocities, another Galileo satellite arrived to assist, equipped with a simple rail launcher to shoot inert slugs of different elements. It began firing. Every slug, no matter what its component atoms, slowed to a halt before reaching the strut, then began to return, picking up speed. After making both passive and active sensor sweeps of the second lattice sphere, the physics team came to their excited conclusion. "Negative mass matter," Tundi announced at the next departmental heads meeting. "Its gravitational force is the opposite of our own.
Therefore, anything made out of ordinary matter will always be repelled. The satellites were able to push through the center of each hole in the negative mass lattice, where the inverted gravity was at its weakest. Anna moved one down to the next level, dipping it into the shoal of tiny pale scintillations that swirled across the gulf between the second and third lattice spheres. Its sensors had trouble tracking the dense will-o'-the-wisps, but eventually the physicists determined it was a tenuous, cold plasma, aggravated by the emissions of the exotic matter below and confined to the gulf by the negative mass above. Analyzing the exotic matter proved even more difficult than with the previous two lattice spheres. They had to launch a whole squadron of large Armstrong-class satellites with their powerful and comprehensive sensor suites. It took a further 2 weeks before they charted the energy currents seething like photonic tempests in the plasma between the two exotic matter spheres. After that, they were able to pilot a satellite through the fourth lattice sphere. When the first Armstrong satellite passed through, it found no further spheres. Instead, the space in the middle, measuring 16,000 kilometers in diameter, housed a series of concentric rings, all of them aligned with the plane of the barrier outside. The outermost, 13,000 kilometers across, the crew immediately named the Daisy Chain. It was a sequence of lenticular disks linked together by a black cable. Next in was a simple ring of green matter, so smooth and uniform it was impossible to tell if it was rotating. Then a braided ring whose thick silver strands moved sinuously around each other like oiled serpents. One of pure scarlet light. More solid loops. Globes, hundreds of thousands of them, strung together in a dense necklace that the bridge officers likened to a strand of alien DNA, twisting around each other as they rotated around the center. Sparks, a wide band of emerald and amber light points trailing cometary tails as they orbited in both directions, though never colliding. There was one of water, or some clear liquid, with a surface beset by waves. Right in the center was emptiness, a little patch of darkness into which light fell. It was God's own orrery. Talk in the starship's canteen was that the lattice spheres powered the rings, or vice versa. Either way, they were all convinced now that the dark fortress was the barrier generator. One by one, the satellites were ordered down toward the rings. One by one, they lost contact with the second chance. The center of the dark fortress was an energistic maelstrom. Human technology could not survive within it. Watching the displays that showed tides of quantum distortions raging chaotically around the wounded satellites, some of the physics team claimed the rings couldn't even exist in normal space-time. What everybody on board wanted to know was if there was a corresponding opening on the other side of the dark fortress. "There's no way we can get anything across the center and past the rings," Tundi said. "If we're going to try this, we'll have to program a satellite to fly around in the gulf between the outer shell and the first lattice sphere. It'll have to operate in autonomous mode. We don't have enough satellites to act as a relay chain over that distance."
"It's a waste of time," Oscar said. "I don't believe there's a hole there. There'd be no damn point to the whole barrier if there was."
"I don't think there is either," Wilson said. "But you know we have to look. Anna, program a Galileo for the assignment."
The flight took 3 days. When the Galileo reemerged into communications range, its sensor log showed the shell opposite the hole was continuous. It had searched over 20,000 square kilometers. Wilson ordered it to be refueled and sent it out again. After 7 flights, it had scanned the entire hemisphere on the other side of the barrier. There was no hole, no passage through to the imprisoned star. 3 months after they discovered the Dark Fortress, Wilson called Oscar and Tundi to his cabin for a mission conference.
"I need to know if we're going to learn anything more from the Dark Fortress," he said to Tundi.
"Are you joking?" the surprised physicist asked. "There is more exotic physics in there than the human race has discovered since an apple fell on Newton's head."
"I'm sure there is. But now we have the major components identified. How much can you and your team realistically add to that? I mean, we don't even know if this really does generate the barrier."
"It's a logical conclusion.
Admittedly, yes. But can you prove it? More importantly, can you prove it with the sensors and instruments we have available on board?
Tundi looked defiant for a moment, but eventually nodded reluctantly.
No.
Not a chance, really. As you say, we can map what's there. But determining function and interconnectivity,
on this scale, it's the kind of project which would absorb every living theorist for the next 2 centuries.
We need a bigger ship. In fact, we need to establish an outpost the size of the High Angel,
and with its manufacturing capacity,
the Commonwealth will have to open a chain of wormholes out here. That's the only way we can apply the kind of resources we need to crack this.
It's not going to happen, Oscar said. Oh, I agree it should. But from a political point of view, all you've got here is the mother of all esoteric physics problems. That doesn't gain you the kind of funding you're talking about.
Nigel Sheldon will understand, Tundi said.
Yes, he will, Wilson said. More than anybody, he made this flight possible. But even he can't carry the entire Commonwealth Senate, not for that kind of financial commitment. If we'd found anything out here, anything that indicated why the barrier was established, any hint of a current threat to the Commonwealth, then we might earn ourselves a couple of return missions at the very least. But it's an enigma, and we've lived with enigmas for a long time now. We're shocked and excited by them at first, then we just learn to live with them. Eventually, we don't even question them anymore. Look at the Sylphon. Why don't electronics work on their worlds? How the hell do they really travel between star systems? Our popular myth has it there are forest paths between worlds. That's what the more whimsical members of our race believe. More practical people believe they spread themselves across the galaxy with arc ships millennia ago. It doesn't matter. Because we live with it, it doesn't affect us. Now, as far as we can determine, the barrier, for all its grandeur, isn't going to affect us either. There are no alien battle fleets waiting out here to blow Earth to pieces and steal our gold and our women. This is just one more incomprehensible relic that will take us 500 years to understand. One day, after that, you and I will be standing here and laughing at how puzzled we once were.
You're taking us home, aren't you?
Tundi realized. Not immediately, but we've certainly devoted enough time to the Dark Fortress. Unless either of you have a viable alternative, I'm going to continue with our flight around the barrier. After that, if there's nothing else to be found, we'll examine the poles as originally planned. We might follow up with a fast examination of Dyson Beta. I'd like to confirm that it is the same before we head for home.
I'll concur with that, Oscar said. Team leaders are getting asked how much longer the investigation is going to last. Nobody has actually complained yet, but I'd say it's time to move on.
They both looked at Tundi.
All right, he said. We do have enough data to keep the universities busy for a decade. But I hope to God you're wrong about the next stage of the project. Understanding the technology in the Dark Fortress would elevate our species to unbelievable heights. We would become transgalactic, for heaven's sake. There really would be no limits to what we could achieve.
Anna and her little team of controllers recalled the satellites, carefully threading them back through the moving maze that was the 4 lattice spheres. Out of the 37 they'd deployed inside the Dark Fortress, 9 had been lost, either in the center or due to communications failure. When the remainder were back in their hangar cradles, Tu Li sent the second chance back into hyperspace at a speed that would complete the circuit of the barrier in another 5 days.
The alarm brought Wilson struggling out of a deep, comfortable sleep. He floundered around on the cot for a second, trying to shield his eyes from the cabin lights that had switched on automatically. Anna groaned, squinting and blinking.
What the fuck? She grunted.
The bridge has declared an emergency, Wilson's e-butler told him.
Son of a bitch!
He rolled off the cot and headed straight for the door. His virtual vision was flashing up dozens of icons. It was difficult to focus on them and the corridor he was half running down. Fortunately, the starship's designers had stuck with maritime tradition and kept the captain's quarters close to the bridge. The status icons didn't indicate any physical damage to the superstructure, and the hyperdrive was functioning normally. Defense was equally reassuring.
No immediate danger, then. Wilson forced himself to relax as the bridge door slid open for him. That was when he started to review the sensor icons. The heist radar was breaking through the barrier.
Shit!
The bridge's small night shift crew glanced around at his exclamation.
It started a couple of minutes ago, Oscar said as he rose from the command console chair. I ordered a halt to our flight.
Wilson glanced at the forward portals as he sat down in the command chair.
Are we still in the wormhole?
Yes, sir.
Okay, Thule, plot a course directly out of here. Implement it the second I tell you.
Aye, sir.
Both portals were showing the heist radar scan of the barrier surface. It seemed to be fluctuating, bowing inward, as if it was being bombarded by projectiles. Then Wilson acknowledged the scale. If objects were hitting it, they'd be the size of gas giants. The hostile force. The reason the barrier was established.
Astrophysics. Do we know what's causing that?
No, sir, Bruno said cheerfully. Not a clue.
Is there anything else out here? A ship? Some weapon system which could be causing that?
Nothing, Sandy Lanier reported from the sensor console. The heist radar scan is clean for 1,000 AUs this side of the barrier.
Wilson frowned at the bridge portals. The fluctuations were growing larger.
And they weren't going to find out why sitting out here, peering over the parapet. Decision time.
Hyperdrive. Take us in to 1,000,000 kilometers of the barrier, Wilson ordered. Defense, force fields on. Let's see what's happening.
The rest of the bridge day shift arrived, sitting at the consoles that had been left unmanned, or standing behind the night shift. The atmosphere of nerves and genuine excitement was the same as Wilson remembered from the Eagle II's cabin as they came in to land. He rubbed his hands slightly self-consciously over his creased white T-shirt before brushing his hair off his brow. The chair's leather was already sticking to his bare legs below his sleep shorts. For a moment he considered hurrying off to change. It was hardly the most dignified image for history, and the onboard sensors were definitely recording. But then half the bridge crew was dressed the same.
Ah, what the hell.
1,000,000 kilometers, sir,
Sandy Lanier reported.
Take us out of hyperspace.
One of the portals switched to an image of pure aquamarine blue. Dark streaks blossomed from the center and peeled open. This time they didn't have to switch the sensors to infrared to see the barrier.
My God, Tundi said hoarsely. It's becoming transparent.
Dyson Alpha was wavering in and out of visibility, 30 AUs ahead of them, only marginally brighter than the rest of the stars behind. The fluctuations indicated by the heist radar scan were inaccurate. The barrier wasn't moving in any physical dimension. It was losing cohesion.
Sensors, defense, is there anything shooting at it? Wilson asked desperately.
No, sir.
No energy of any kind.
Local quantum state is also stable as far as we can tell. The barrier is...
Oh! Wow! It's gone!
Heist radar scans are clear.
The fucker's vanished!
Wilson stared at the two portals. The one with the gravitonic scan was empty. A second later, when the light reached them, Dyson Alpha burned steadily at the center of a colossal blank circle.
We're still seeing the other side of the barrier, he realized.
It's going to take the light from the stars beyond over 4 hours to travel 30 AUs.
Full passive sensor sweep, Wilson ordered. Show me what's in there.
This can't be coincidence, Oscar said.
He sounded shocked, even a little frightened.
It's been there for over 1,000 years, and then it vanishes just as we come along? No way. No goddamn way. Something knows we're here.
The bridge crew were looking around anxiously, seeking reassurance from one another. Wilson had been thinking along similar lines himself. Quite a loud voice in his head was urging him to run, and don't look back. The starfield was beginning to reappear around the edges of the barrier, as light swept in toward the second chance. It gave the rather unfortunate impression of a giant man-trap opening its jaws.
Wilson turned to Tundi. What's the Dark Fortress doing?
The physics section went into a fevered huddle over their consoles, running analysis routines over the heist radar scans.
Wilson watched the results coming through on one of his desk screens. Not that he could understand the details, but the overall impression was easy enough. "There's still something there," Tundy said. "Heist radar scan shows it's smaller than before. We're probably picking up the outer lattice sphere. Wait. Yes, it's rotating. The shell has gone, and there's a very strange quantum fluctuation signature inside it. That wasn't there before."
"A wormhole?" Wilson asked.
"No, I don't recognize it at all."
"Threat assessment."
Tundy gave him a slightly irked look. "Nothing obvious. I'll get back to you on that one." A picture of Dyson Alpha's planetary system was building up on one of the bridge portals. The two gas giants were both smaller than Jupiter, orbiting at 4.5 AUs and 17 AUs from their star. The largest of the three solid planets had a diameter of 14,000 kilometers and orbited 1.2 AUs out from the Sun. The remaining two were both smaller and in mildly ecliptic orbits, a lot farther out. They called the innermost planet Alpha Major and focused the starship's main sensor suite on it.
"My God," Sandy Lanier said. "Will you look at those readings?"
Alpha Major's visual spectrum showed water on a scale that indicated oceans and an oxygen-nitrogen atmosphere. It was also a strong source of neutrinos. "A very heavy level of fusion activity," Russell commented. "I'd say total power generation exceeds our big 15 worlds combined."
"What the hell uses that much power?" Oscar muttered.
A measurable percentage of it, they discovered, was pumped into communications. Throughout the electromagnetic spectrum, the planet was shining like a small nova. The starship's RI began recording the multitude of overlapping signals, but without a key, none of its decryption algorithms were of any use. The greatest fusion usage was the most obvious to see. Space above Alpha Major was thick with activity. Slender, brilliant threads of fusion drives created their own ring nebula, extending from the upper atmosphere out to 1 million kilometers. Fleets of ships were accelerating at 3 or 4 Gs away from the planet, slashing long scars of plasma across the void before finally cutting their engines to coast to destinations across the star system. Hundreds more were on their approach, firing their engines to decelerate into the perpetual swarms circling the planet. Over 50 moonlets were in orbit 200,000 kilometers out, with knots of small fusion flames wrapped around them as ships came and went. They must have been captured asteroids. Their orbit and spacing was too regular to occur naturally. Each one was surrounded by massive industrial stations.
"Don't they care about their environment?" Antonia asked.
"It can't be safe having fusion ships flying that close to a habitable planet."
"Those are big ships," Anna said. "At least the same size as the Second Chance. Some are a lot bigger.
And their exhaust is helium. They're probably using boron fusion."
"Expensive," Antonia muttered. "Depends on your technology level," Oscar said. "This is not a primitive civilization."
"Where are the ships going?" Wilson asked. The Second Chance began to expand its observation. They found an astonishing level of technological activity on and around every planet. The two outer solid planets, though cold and airless, were dotted by vast force field domes, artificial habitats whose vegetation matched the spectrum to be found on the land masses of Alpha Major. Fusion globe suns illuminated each one. Spacecraft were almost as numerous as above Alpha Major, wrapping the worlds in a perpetual flexing toroid of blazing light. They also had dozens of industrialized moonlets. Out among the gas giants, the pattern was repeated. Every large moon was home to the habitat force field domes and surrounded by ships and industrialized moonlets. The thin rings orbiting the gas giants played host to thousands of stations that latched on to the rocky particles, slowly digesting them. As for the dozens of outermost moons, rocks that were essentially large asteroids, force field habitats had engulfed them completely. Tightly walled contortions in the magnetosphere revealed colossal structures in low equatorial orbit. When the Second Chance's sensors tracked them, they found they were trailing cables or pipes down into the upper cloud bands.
As the details appeared on the bridge portal, they made Wilson nostalgic for the future he'd thought he was pioneering back in 2050, the never-happened golden era of humanity's high frontier. This was the kind of inter-system society any technological civilization would eventually build if it was somehow cut off from the stars. Why would it be cut off, though? 3 hours after the barrier had vanished, Sandy turned the sensor console over to Anna, though she hung around for a couple of hours to see what developed. One of the secondary telescopes was watching the turmoil that was space around Alpha Major. "Looks like some ships are heading out system," Anna said. 11 streaks of fusion plasma were visible beyond the distance when most of the ships had powered down to a coast flight mode, accelerating at 5 Gs, and have been for 3 hours now. "That's one hell of a velocity they're hitting. I hope they've got force field protection. A small molecule can seriously ruin your day at that speed." "I'm tracking several similar flights from both gas giants," Jean Duvois said. "Any coming our way?" Wilson asked.
"Not really, sir. 4 are on an interception course for the Dark Fortress. One of the others will pass within 8 AUs.
"Safe enough, but keep tracking it. If it alters course in our direction, I want to know about it."
"Aye, sir."
"Tundi, do you think they're capable of detecting our HICE radar scans?"
"I'd say they have the technology to detect quantum wave fluctuations, which might give them an indirect clue we were here. But we haven't detected any HICE radar emissions from inside the star system, so they probably haven't got a direct detector. Why would you build a HICE radar if you're confined inside a barrier 30 AUs across?"
"Do they have the technology to build the barrier?" Wilson asked sharply.
Tundi grimaced, reluctant to give an opinion.
"I'd say not.
Judging from what we've seen, I'd put them on a par with us, except that they don't have wormholes. The Dark Fortress is orders of magnitude above anything we're capable of."
"That implies the barrier was put up by an outside agency."
"It's looking that way, yes."
"They were confined inside, then. Someone thought they were a threat."
Wilson turned his attention back to the magnificent astroengineering accomplishments which the sensors were revealing. Given his background, it was hard not to be envious of Dyson Alpha's civilization.
"Why?" "I'm more concerned about why it was switched off," Oscar said. "Somebody observed us here."
"That doesn't make a lot of sense," Wilson said.
"If you were attempting to close off this civilization, why remove the barrier the first time a ship investigates it?"
"They didn't attempt to cut them off," Tu Li said. "They succeeded."
"Which makes switching the barrier off all the more nonsensical."
"I don't know what you're worrying about it for," Anna said. "There's a simple way of finding out now." The bridge crew all looked at her. She grinned back, small spiral ock tattoos on her cheeks shimmering a soft silver. "Ask them," she said, and pointed at the portal. On the third day after the barrier fell, they used the HICE radar to scan the system. Wilson had heard every argument for and against making contact. Most people, himself included, were being cautious despite what they'd seen of the Dyson aliens. Dudley Bowes was eager to start hailing them, while Oscar wanted to turn the second chance around and head straight back to the Commonwealth. He was still badly worried by the timing of the barrier coming down. It was the first time Wilson really wished they had instantaneous communications back to the Commonwealth. He would have been relieved to pass the buck on this question. Anna was right. They could learn a lot from initiating contact. But now that it looked certain the Dyson aliens had been confined, shipboard speculation was heavily focused on the reason. Their civilization was impressive, but not that threatening. There were now 83 ships heading out from the star system. After 3 days of continual flight at 5 G's acceleration, the first wave had now traveled over 10 AUs, and still more were being launched. The first ships from the outermost gas giant had almost reached the boundary where the barrier had been. Nobody on board the second chance could work out what they intended to do once they were outside the 30 AU limit, as the ships weren't designed for interstellar travel. But the crew had spent their time gathering more data on the Dyson Alpha system. It wasn't just the planets that had been colonized. There were 2 asteroid belts,
one on either side of Alpha Major's orbit, which were extensively settled, and each of the gas giant Trojan points, with their broad cluster of medium-sized planetoids, accommodated thriving space-borne societies. More intriguing, certainly to the physicists, was the swarm of rings, 500 kilometers in diameter and protected by force fields, which were orbiting 3 million kilometers above the star's corona. They seemed to be absorbing the solar wind, siphoning in massive currents of elementary particles that jetted out of the flares and sunspots below them. Wilson finally authorized the use of the HICE radar to obtain a more detailed chart of the star system and its inhabitants. Nobody was really surprised when it showed tens of thousands of the big ships coasting between planets, moons, asteroid habitats, and the industrial stations. The total was slightly unnerving given how alone the second chance was. Also unforeseen were the number of stray asteroids they detected out beyond the second gas giant that showed signs of colonization and industrial activity. Three of them were only a couple of AUs away. Wilson gave Sandy Lanier, the duty sensor officer, a very hard time for not picking up their neutrino emissions earlier. He paid for it that night when Anna gave him a lecture on how small the fusion generators were and how big space in general was. They must be just starting to build on those asteroids, she claimed heatedly. If there's anything big and dangerous close to the ship, our department will spot it for you. He managed to grumble a mild apology and said they should take a really good look at the nearby asteroids. Having examples of the Dyson civilization so close was an excellent chance to learn what they could without being observed themselves. She accepted the apology and let him kiss and make up. They were getting good at finding innovative ways to use the low G of the crew ring. With a more complete picture of Dyson Alpha's system established, the starship's HICE radar was focused on Dyson Beta. The range was extreme, but even so, the return showed that the barrier around the second star remained intact. It strengthened Oscar's argument that the removal of Dyson Alpha's barrier had been triggered by their arrival. Not that anyone could come up with a convincing reason why, and the scenario certainly wasn't one of the contingency plans so carefully prepared before they left Anshun. All of which left Wilson even more aware of how critical his decisions were now. He ordered the sensor department to resume collecting information on the Dyson Alpha system. It was while they were scanning the nearby asteroids for high-resolution images that the first firefight broke out a third of the way around the star system. The electromagnetic sensors spotted it first, several large EM pulses erupting halfway between the orbits of the two gas giants. They were quickly confirmed as nuclear explosions. The second barrage broke out as exhaust plumes suddenly streaked out all around the trio of explosions, exposing two squadrons of over 30 ships converging on each other. The fighting had started when they were a million kilometers apart. Now they were all accelerating toward each other at over 7 Gs. Missiles and gamma lasers turned the shrinking gap into a lethal hurricane of energy. Exploding ships added their fury to the radiation deluge. HICE radar swiftly scanned the area in real time, finding a large, expanding cloud of debris and vapor with several ruined ships tumbling through it. 32 million kilometers away, five colonized asteroids were surrounded by a shoal of ships whose active sensors were probing the battle zone. "Glad we weren't there," Oscar exclaimed. Wilson stared at the display with its crumbling flecks of irradiated matter hurtling apart. It reminded him of the ridiculous slow-motion explosions in the blockbuster films of his youth, where steroidal Hollywood action stars outran the blast wave. "Defense," he asked slowly. "Could our force fields have stood up to that kind of assault?"
"The initial blast, sir, possibly, but it got pretty hellish in there toward the end."
"Thank you." He glanced at Oscar and inclined his head. The two of them went into the senior officer's briefing room and opaqued the glass wall. Screens around the long central table glowed blue and crimson from the sensor graphics they were showing.
"I know what you're thinking," Wilson said as he sat on a corner of the table. "It's not difficult. I've been saying it ever since the barrier came down. We should leave. These developments have pushed us way outside our original mission scenario.
We were supposed to be a scouting flight. This is something else entirely. I know, I know.
Wilson ran his hand back through his hair. It was getting longer than he liked.
But we still don't know why they were confined, and we certainly don't know who or what put the barrier up. We were sent here to find out. That means we haven't completed our mission, not to my satisfaction.
That fight was a damn good indicator why they were penned up in here. It doesn't come any clearer than that to me.
Maybe. But we can't go home with just an assumption. I need to be certain.
It's not just the Dyson civilization you have to consider, Wilson. Why was that barrier taken down for us? Doesn't that bother you?
Of course it does. But the people who can tell us about the barrier are right here.
We can't ask them. It's too risky. In our whole history, the human race has only ever let off 5 nuclear warheads in anger. And they were under the most extraordinary, exceptional circumstances. That fight of theirs just saw 872 fusion bombs detonating inside of 30 minutes, and half of them had diverted energy output functions. They are dangerous, Wilson. Very, very dangerous.
The kind of weapons involved in any conflict are determined by the nature of the battleground and the technology available.
If we are attacked out here, I'm quite prepared to use our nukes. It would be an appropriate response. Does my willingness to do my duty make the human race a bunch of dangerous killers?
You're twisting this. I'm on record here. I don't like this situation. It is my opinion we should leave.
We can't. For all its unexpected outcome, this is why we're here.
Discovery and opportunity, Oscar. We can't turn our back on it.
That would be less than human. I'm going to authorize a remote investigatory contact.
Oscar closed his eyes and let out a long, dispirited breath.
Okay. It is your choice, and I will support it. But can we at least be cautious about it?
Wilson smiled at him. Believe me, we are going to be so cautious you'll think I've turned dangerously paranoid. They set out the rules of contact at the next daily departmental heads meeting, drawing on the Commonwealth protocols for alien contact and adapting them to their own unique situation.
It is my intention to discover what we can about the Dyson aliens without ourselves being observed, Wilson said. Now we've seen how volatile they are. I am not prepared to take the second chance into orbit around any planet or moon. God alone knows what weapon systems they have in orbit around their large population centers.
The initial investigation will be a contact team deployment to a deserted artifact, something big, an abandoned habitat or wrecked spaceship, Oscar said. Anything that will show us how they live, give us an indication of their physical shape, their culture. If we get lucky, there might be some electronic memory units we can access. Whatever we choose, it will be a minimum of 5 million kilometers from any settlement or ship. We can manage a 5G acceleration in an emergency combat situation, which is significantly lower than most of the ships we've seen flying around out there. So our primary tactical advantage is our FTL drive. I'd like to avoid any sort of chase altogether. Therefore, the whole procedure will be conducted on a minimum emission basis.
Before we begin this investigation, I'd like some idea of their response if we're exposed to them, Wilson said.
He glanced around the table until he found Emmanuel Verbeke, their alien culture officer.
Can you give us any insight on their society yet?
Very little other than the obvious, she said. What we've seen matches our standard simulations for a non-FTL technological species. They followed a logical, progressive route of development across their star system. Given the extent and obvious success of their colonization, I am slightly puzzled by the fight we saw. I would have expected more social stability, but as we really know nothing about their culture, it would be inappropriate to speculate too much on the conflict at this point. We've made no progress on decrypting any of their signals, Anna said. That's worrying. I don't expect the RI algorithms to begin immediate translations, but there were some areas I expected progress with.
Such as? Oscar asked.
Video or holographic signals, for a start. There are basic formatting rules which data of that nature has to follow.
Even if they see an ultraviolet or air sonar, there will be display template patterns that can be determined. So far, we haven't found any. Their transmissions seem to be almost completely random, and they're all analog signals, which is even stranger. Of course, it doesn't help that we're receiving so many of them. Overlap and interference is considerable. I would at least have hoped to play you an example of their language by now, but I can't even do that.
It is unusual that we don't even know what they look like, Emmanuel said. If the situation were reversed, and the Dyson aliens were lurking close to a Commonwealth world, they would soon be able to gain an understanding of us from what we broadcast.
We are recording it all, Anna said. If we eventually make contact, and the Dyson aliens want to talk to us, then we'll have a full understanding of whatever communicative pathways they employ. After that, we can start translating the signals we're recording now. It'll be helpful in case they start restricting their output when they find out we're here. What we're receiving at the moment could be quite valuable later on.
You mean we're catching them off guard? Wilson asked.
Essentially, yes.
Okay, I don't have any problem with that. If they find us creeping around out here, are they likely to attack? Oscar asked.
If it was me, I'd be curious, Emmanuel said. But that's a personal thing. It's also a human thing. Given our current knowledge base, there really is no way of knowing.
Then we will conduct the investigation on a worst-case basis, Wilson said. The contact team will be armed and have fire authority if threatened. The second chance will operate on combat alert as soon as we cross the old barrier threshold.
For the first time since the barrier fell, Oscar actually looked happy.
Anna, did you find anything suitable for us to start with? Wilson asked.
Yes, actually. There are a lot of spaceship wrecks floating around out there. She gave Oscar an uncomfortable look. It would appear the Dyson aliens do fight a lot among themselves. I think we do genuinely need to be cautious.
We will be, Wilson said, giving her a warning stare. Have you got a suitable starting point for us?
I think so, yes.
Nobody actually said anything, but the bridge crew was very conscious of passing inside the line where the barrier had been. Was it going to spring back into existence, trapping them? The Heiss radar scanned behind them, scouring space and hyperspace. There was no change to the quantum signature of space-time. Nothing altered in or around the Dark Fortress. They waited just inside the barrier line for over an hour before Wilson finally said,
"Okay, Thule, take us over to the rock."
"Aye, sir."
McLean Gilbert waited in the contact team's operational office, not too far away from the bridge. By contrast, this compartment had only a couple of consoles, but a lot more display screens. Three long tables were seating most of his 40-strong team members, who were regarding the blank screens with a controlled patience. The absence of any current sensor data couldn't damp the sense of excitement vibrating around the room. It was present in the short, terse comments shot between friends, the way shift rotors had been forgotten so everyone could cram in, drink packets on the tables, lack of the usual horseplay. The contact team was finally coming into its own. So far, they had been the most underused department on board, simply looking over everyone else's shoulder as vast quantities of physics data flowed back into the starship. Now that tolerance and waiting was being rewarded. Oscar came in just as the second chance emerged from its wormhole. Mac waved him into the vacant chair next to his own, and together they watched the wormhole's blue light fade off the screens, allowing the cameras to focus on the chunk of rock they were rendezvoused with. Anna, who found it and therefore had the right, had named it the Watchtower. It was a long slice of rock, with a station of some kind at one end. Given its tower-like shape and its position, 1.5 AUs beyond the outer gas giant orbit, she felt it analogous to some ancient imperial outpost, a long-forgotten garrison fort, watching across the desolate barbarian territories for anything that could threaten civilization.
"Looks like we were right about it being inactive," Oscar said. "Thankfully."
Long-range passive scans had shown no infrared emission. There was no neutrino activity or electromagnetic broadcasts. As the rock had a fast rotation,
once every 26 minutes, they had concluded it was now abandoned, most probably a victim of some ancient battle. As he watched the images appear, backed up by the slow trickle of data, Mac was convinced they were right. The rock was fashioned like a sharp blade, over a kilometer and a half long, but never more than a couple of hundred meters wide. Every side was sheer, with razor edges, obviously a splinter that had snapped off cleanly from whatever asteroid had been nuked into oblivion. "That must have been one brute of an explosion," Mac said idly. "We've never seen them build anything on a small asteroid." The station was rooted in the surface at the wider end of the fragment. Cubes and pyramids and mushrooms of polytitanium composite made up the bulk of it, their once strong hulls now brittle from centuries of vacuum exposure. Crumbling fissures exposed reinforcement ribs below, while the color had been mottled down to a grubby lead gray by uncountable micrometeorite punctures and constant molecular ablation. Spiky fungal structures molded from toughened plastics and metalloceramics lurked between the larger sections. They too were fraying around the edges, leaving long, delicate strands poking out from ragged cavities.
"At least you won't have any trouble gaining access," Oscar told him. "There are more holes than walls."
"Yeah, on the upper sections. Those lower portions look more intact." "Ah, here we go. The deep scans coming in." They leaned forward in unison, peering at the small hologram portal that was now showing a three-dimensional map of the station's internal layout.
"That looks like a surrealist's maze," Oscar said. "It's got to be some kind of industrial refinery. Those are all pipes, aren't they?"
"Or corridors, or Warren tunnels. Remember the Jarrowfly nests we found on Tandil?
We thought they were just beautiful coral outcrops until the swarm came out." "Yeah, maybe."
Oscar gave his friend a wide smile.
"Only one way to be sure."
"Right. Send us in to do the dirty work."
"Never fails." "Damn right. I'll just lounge around in here. Maybe have me one of those gourmet meals from the canteen, then access a hot TSI drama. But you be sure to enjoy yourself in those ball squeezer suits of yours while you're over there.
Once I set foot on that lump of rock, make first contact with the Dysons, it'll be my name that our race remembers, not yours."
"Tut-tut, vanity. The most tragic sin of all. Hey, Mr. Legend, what are your first words going to be when you set that photogenic foot down?"
Mac struck a sincerely thoughtful pose.
"I thought something like, 'Fuck me, now I remember why you shouldn't eat curry before you put on a spacesuit.'" "Cool. Historic, even. I like that."
Mac grinned, then stood up. "Okay, everybody, eyes and ears to the front, please. Our captain is going to hold the second chance 100 kilometers off the watchtower as a safety precaution. That means we'll be using the shuttles to get ourselves over there. Preliminary scouting party will be myself and Team C. The main objective on the first flight is to ascertain occupancy levels. If that is confirmed as zero, we'll conduct an initial survey. Following that, I want to operate a rotating 3-team shift pattern to map out the watchtower's contents. As you can see, there's a lot of pipes and tunnels and shit to get through. We're going archaeological on this one, which I know is a little different from the kind of exploration most of you are used to. What we need is clues as to what these critters look like, what they eat, what they drink, who they voted for, if their team won the cup, all that crap. So what you have to track down are artifacts that will open any sort of window into their culture for us. Teams B and F, I want you to concentrate on their electronics, or optronics, or difference engines, or whatever the hell they used. If there are any data fragments left in any system over there, I want them downloaded and copied. Got all that?" A rumble of happy agreement went around the room. "Fine, Team C, with me now. We're suiting up. Shuttle departs in 30 minutes. Now, while we're scratching around over there, Oscar here is assuming his usual job of exploration supervisor, which means he'll be watching our asses from his nice, comfortable office chair. I'm sure you remember the drill. All major decisions are his. I don't want any rogue calls on this one. No, I'm just going around the next corner because it looks interesting.
If there's any doubt about something, clear it with Oscar first. Team A, you're our direct observation monitors on the first flight. B, D, E, if we okay the site, you're on next. I suggest you get some rest accordingly. He turned to leave. Oscar caught his arm. I know everyone thinks I'm obsessing over the barrier coming down, Oscar said, but take care over there. Don't worry. Coward is my middle name. It wasn't until a full 24 hours after Mac had landed on the watchtower that Dudley Bowes finally got his chance to regain some of the limelight. He'd thought that as a member of Contact Team A, he would be among the first humans to meet the Dysons. That hadn't happened, of course, not with McLean Gilbert preempting him. Dudley had considered his pre-departure appointment to the Starship's contact team as a smooth move. After all, Wilson and his senior officers couldn't deny he was the Commonwealth's expert on the Dyson pair, from an astrophysics angle at any rate. And with his first life engineering degree expanding his knowledge base on a practical level, he was an obvious choice for the contact team as well as the science staff. So far on the voyage, his knowledge had been left sadly unapplied. He understood very little about the quantum state of the barrier. Managing the university's astronomy department single-handed had left very little time for him to keep up to date on the theoretical front of physics. And although the insides of the Dark Fortress remained visually spectacular, he was unable to offer any insight on the nature of the gargantuan mechanism. While the second chance was examining the Dark Fortress, he had spent most of his time alone in his cabin recording commentaries. His contract with Graumund Web News called for informed opinions and interpretation of the information that the Starship gathered, to be a pop science pundit, basically. So he would watch the day's results come in and provide an explanation that was dumbed down to the lowest level possible. His time as a lecturer, reducing complex facts to a series of easily digestible chunks, followed by his meteoric exposure to the media and their demands for simplified soundbite presentations, made him perfectly qualified for the job. But the watchtower had finally presented him with the opportunity to enhance his profile. Physically placing him on the ultimate human frontier would make it his flight. He, Dudley Bowes, was due to become the human interface with the mystery of the Dyson pair. Then McLean Gilbert announced the team schedule, and Dudley had to wait for yet another day. Until it became his turn, he was once again reduced to a secondary role, watching through the shuttle's camera as Gilbert jetted himself over to the large alien structures on the watchtower and spouting banalities like, "This is it. Any moment now. Yes. Contact. How much this differs from our usual first encounters with an alien environment. CST contact personnel normally walk through a wormhole and step firmly on the ground. Here, you can see my friend, Mac, actually having to cling on to the edge of a hole with his hand. Now, wait. He's shining his light through into the structure. You're seeing the first glimpse of a whole new alien universe." In truth, Mac's careful drift through the structure was tedium itself. It was quite obvious the station had been deserted for a long time. The Polytanium hull was still mildly radioactive, its decay rate allowing an accurate dating on the explosion of 211 years. So there can be nothing left alive in there. Or if there is, it's a life form very different from anything we know. The compartments weren't particularly strange. Engineering principles were reasonably universal. The hull material was made up from sandwiched layers: the pressure wall, thermal insulation, structural reinforcement, cable ducts. First indications were that the cube Mac entered was a habitation section. Several internal walls had rectangular hatchways. They are 2 meters across, larger than human ones, which indicate that Dysons might be bigger than us, in case you couldn't work that out for yourselves. There were times Dudley hated himself for what he had to do. Almost every compartment had an opening into the broad tunnel-like corridors that curved and twisted through the interior. Mac's suit lights found octagonal mounting blocks in the compartments, jutting out of the walls at the apex of structural ribs. At one time they'd held large units of machinery. Now there were just empty brackets and load pins. "It's been stripped clean,"
Whoever won the battle must have taken their booty with them.
Mac's whole EVA was a record of empty chambers and long dark tunnels. The watchtower had a sense of rejection about it, rather than abandonment. Cold, dark, feebly radioactive, it was simply of no consequence anymore. Both purpose and meaning had ceased when the lethal radiation pierced every corner. It was an impression that was now strengthening in Dudley's mind, as he watched the horn of rock expanding across the starfield. Everything out here was grey, leaving very little difference between the rock and the alien station perched on it. He could just make out the other shuttle hovering above the cube, a silver and gold speck with green and scarlet navigation strobes flashing incessantly. Their light shimmered across the scuff marks on the perspex of the little port he was pressed against.
Helmut?
Huh? Dudley turned around to see Emmanuel Verbicki on the other side of the aisle. She was putting her own helmet on.
Time to put your helmet on, she said.
Right. Sure. He gave her a thank you smile and retrieved his helmet from the fuse tube patch on the side of the chair. He had gotten on quite well with Emmanuel since leaving Anshun. Thankfully, since they were partnered up together in Team A. Not that he got to socialize with her much outside duty shifts and training sessions. He was still somewhat conscious about his physical shape. Everyone else on board had been through a full rejuvenation, at most 10 years ago. He was the starship's official geriatric. Any early hope that would give him an air of distinction had quickly faded. The shuttle's small thrusters were firing almost continually as it maneuvered in for rendezvous, sounding as if someone with a hammer was knocking on the fuselage. Dudley accommodated the slight swaying motion it set up as he lowered the tough transparent bubble over his head. The lip-like seals gripped tight, and he fastened the secondary mechanical seal. His E-butler immediately ran final integration checks, confirming the suit was fully functional. He activated his suit's force field as he went into the airlock. Team C and three of Team A were already waiting on the fuselage grid that skirted the outer lock. Dudley took care to anchor himself before pulling his maneuvering pack out of its storage bin. It was McLean Gilbert himself who held the pack steady while Dudley pushed his arms through the straps. The unit stuck itself to his spacesuit, plastic straps contracting around him.
You all right? Mac asked.
His helmet was very close to Dudley's, allowing him to peer through the faint silvering.
Sure.
However blasé he tried to sound, the reality of being out in open space within an alien star system was making his heart judder. The telemetry would be available to Mac. Dudley looked around to find the reassuring bright star that was Second Chance. Seeing it shining against the starfield made his breathing a little easier. He searched farther, trying to find familiar star patterns amid the strange constellations. Team C began jetting over to the watchtower 100 meters away. Dudley held Emmanuel's maneuvering pack as she shrugged her way into it, receiving a thumbs up in gratitude. He enjoyed that. It made him feel like a fully paid-up member of the team.
Right, that's everybody out, said Francis Rawlins, the leader of Team C. Make sure you've secured your equipment bag before you leave the shuttle. You can free flight in your own time. Head for the beacon they've put up on the alien station. We'll regroup there and move on in.
Dudley made sure the cylindrical bag was fastened to his belt. The others were slowly lifting off the fuselage grid. Tiny squirts of white gas puffed out of their maneuvering pack nozzles, just visible in the dusky light of the distant star. His virtual hand gripped the pack's joystick, and he tilted it forward. The gas produced a dull rushing sound, vibrating against his back, but his boots left the grid, and he was floating away from the shuttle. Once again his heart went yammering as adrenaline cut loose into his bloodstream. He couldn't believe he was actually doing this. There was a holiday he'd taken in his first life when he'd signed up to go paragliding, trusting himself to a sheet of fabric and praying the straps held as he and the instructor jumped off the top of a mountain. The rush of tension and exhilaration that hit him simultaneously when he saw treetops below his feet was like nothing he'd ever known. Now, here it was again, far more intense than the first time. As before, he forced himself to relax into the inevitable. It just took a while to convince his body there was actually nothing wrong,
that the suit and the maneuvering pack were working fine and taking care of him. Inside the helmet, he was grinning like a madman. His free virtual hand tapped a microphone icon, then keyed in a privacy code. "I'm approaching the strange alien station we've called the Watchtower. All of us agree now that it was misnamed. This is no guard outpost, simply the sad remnants of an industrial facility that was damaged during a conflict that went nuclear. I can't help but feel regret that all the effort and cost which went into establishing such an enterprise should fall victim to this primitive lack of emotional control. Although the Dyson aliens have accomplished so much, and I concede some of their technological accomplishments exceed ours, I hope they can still learn from the way our society resolves conflicts and disagreements. That would go down well back home. Always make the audience feel slightly superior." The coarse graphic inside his virtual vision showed him heading off to one side of the beacon. He corrected. Over-corrected. Then had to tip the joystick firmly the other way. This was exactly what his skilled training memory instinctively warned him against. He just couldn't integrate that knowledge at an automatic reflex level. So he wobbled his way forward, gas burping from every nozzle of his maneuvering pack in a seemingly random pattern, and keeping a cautious eye on his relative velocity. Frances Rawlins was easing her way in through the gap beside the beacon as he finally came to rest just above her. The other members of Team C followed. Dudley looked around eagerly once he was inside, but the compartment was something of an anticlimax, a simple box of blue-gray metal, flooded with vibrant pools of light by the suit beams. Nothing to hint at alienness. "Now we're inside, I can't emphasize enough to use caution," Francis said. "The ops office is watching out for us individually, but they can't compensate for every mistake. The only solution is, don't make any. We're not in a race. We'll keep searching around until we've acquired the data which the captain needs, so don't rush anything. Now, teams B, D, and E have already explored down to level 5, and radially they went as far as sections A3 and A8 on your charts. They've placed comm relays to cover that area. But when you go beyond them, you need to set up your own. These walls are an effective block to our signals. Do not allow any communications dead zones, especially in the connecting tunnels. We stay in contact the whole time, understood? Okay, you've got your assignments. Move out." Dudley studied the topography of the 3D chart in his virtual vision, matching it to the big tunnel entrance on the compartment's wall. An orange line snaked through it, detailing his route. He brought the inertial guidance online, aligning it with the beacon. "You ready?" Emmanuel asked. "I think so." He was staring at the black gulf that was the entrance to the tunnel they were going to have to use to get down to level 5. It was nearly 3 meters in diameter, thus indicating the Dyson aliens may be bigger than us, idiot. Not so small as to trigger claustrophobia, at least not straight away. On the other side of the compartment, Francis was already hauling herself into a tunnel that snaked its way over to section A8. Dudley drifted over to the tunnel his chart indicated and gripped the side of the entrance to steady himself. His suit lights cut straight through the gloom, revealing a tube whose carbon composite walls were mottled with hairline fractures and coarse blisters. It started to curve downward about 5 meters ahead, with a gentle twist to the left. He pushed his feet lightly off the compartment floor, allowing his legs and torso to slide up until he was leveled to the entrance, then pulled himself forward into the tunnel, and into the unknown. "Sir, we're being signaled," Anna called out. "Sensors are showing both lasers and microwave transmissions directed straight at us. Originating from Alpha Major Orbit, the Moonlets."
"Son of a bitch," Wilson grunted. "Are you sure?
Could they just be aligned on something beyond us?"
"I don't think so. There is nothing behind us. All three beams intersect here, and they're holding constant. We're definitely the target point."
Wilson quickly called the signals up on his console screens. Even after the RI's best filtering, they came up as a jumble of sine waves and fractal patterns.
"Is this the same stuff they transmit to each other?"
"Yes, sir. It looks like it."
"So they might not realize we are aliens."
"They must have a good idea we are not native to this star system," Tundi said. "After all,
Now the barrier has come down. They'll be expecting some kind of communication or contact from the species which put it up. They would be watching. One of the visual sensors was trained on a laser beam coming from a worldlet around Alpha Major. That single ruby dazzle point obscured much of the planet's delicate wrapping of fusion flame. Wilson stared at it with a growing concern that he might just have been underestimating the Dysons.
They've been looking for us, or at least an alien ship, since the barrier went down.
That would be the logical thing for them to do, yes.
So if they haven't got HICE radar, how the hell did they find us?
A hyperdrive wormhole creates a great deal of gravitonic shock, and it also has a strong quantum signature. On top of that, there will be neutrino emissions from our fusion reactors. Small ones, Antonia said immediately. I'm keeping the fusion systems a couple of percent above break-even. The Nihiling desyncs are our primary power source, but they're very well shielded.
Captain, this entire planetary system is overflowing with advanced technology, Tundi said, and if they really are as conflict-driven as we suspect, they will have a great many sensor systems. I'm really not surprised they have detected us.
Wilson was drawn back to the main portals, both of them showing an unaugmented visual image of the watchtower. His initial concern was now turning to real worry.
Anna, give me a HICE radar sweep. Is there anything out there?
After a few initial scans of the watchtower, they'd switched off all of their active sensors, keeping all emissions to a minimum in a bid to achieve silent running. It was his choice again to remain inconspicuous, quietly gathering data until they were ready to make contact, a strategy that would allow them the upper hand.
Oh, shit, Anna exclaimed. I make that 8 ships heading straight at us.
Dudley had followed the tunnel all the way down to level 7. He'd passed a lot of junctions where subsidiary tunnels branched off. The whole network was like some kind of root system twisted into a knotted corkscrew configuration. Winding his way down, he began to appreciate just how extensive the tunnels were, in a way the Virtual Vision 3D chart never quite conveyed. As he progressed, he became convinced they were pipes rather than corridors. There were simply too many of them to be used as passageways by the Dyson aliens. Not that he could visualize what kind of pipes they were. They had no valves or pumps, nor mounting pins where such units could have been. His best guess was that they used to be lined by a cellular sleeve, or a variant on electromuscle, which had subsequently been stripped out along with everything else. The contact teams had so far been singularly unsuccessful in recovering an artifact of any value. He glided out from the tunnel into a level 7 compartment shaped like a slice of cake. It didn't have any hatchways, only more tunnel entrances. He touched his boots down on the rumpled floor, allowing the sole cilia to grip the flaking surface. The open space was a welcome relief from the confines of the tunnel. Emmanuel came out behind him, flipping her fingers against the edge as she passed, to turn a lazy circle before placing her boots firmly on the floor. Dudley was already sticking a comm relay to an empty mounting block.
This has been cleaned out, Emmanuel reported. No direct connection to other compartments.
Okay, Oscar said. Tunnel entrance 3 leads down into the rock itself. We don't have an accurate plan of it after 20 meters or so. The deep scan can't penetrate any farther. You guys want to check it out for me?
We can manage that, Dudley said confidently. At last, some real uncharted territory.
All right, proceed with care. Don't forget the comm relays.
Dudley wanted to say something like, of course we won't, but it lacked professionalism. In fact, Oscar's calm voice in his ears was reassuring. You can always depend on Oscar. It was a pleasant psychological safety net. He ordered his boots to release the floor and pushed himself toward entrance 3. With his suit light shining down into the slate-gray interior, it didn't look any different from the dozen others he'd already passed. It was curving away counterclockwise.
Start recording the route, he told his e-butler, and pulled himself in.
After 15 meters, the surface changed from the usual tough carbon composite to a thin aluminum skin, dull with age, and cracked to reveal rock directly underneath. The curvature tightened, becoming regular. Dudley stuck a comm relay to the wall. 25 meters later, he had to use another.
According to my inertial guidance, this is a spiral, Emmanuel said. We're descending almost along the rock's axis.
Oscar, is there a hole anywhere on the rock surface? Dudley asked.
Anything that could be the other end?
Difficult to say. There are a few fissures that could be openings. This is why we need you guys.
Thanks.
After a couple more twists, they came to the first junction. It was a straight tube, 7 meters long. Dudley shone his suit lights down it.
It just leads to the other side of the spiral, like a shortcut.
I don't think so, Emmanuel said. The angle is wrong. Hey, you know what? I bet this whole shaft is laid out like DNA. Two spirals running parallel, with crosslinks between the two.
You could be right.
Oscar, I'd like to try something. If we put a comm relay at the other end of this link, then we might be able to pick it up if there's another crosslink below us.
Go ahead, Dudley. It's worth a try.
Dudley zipped through the short length of tunnel, happy at how easy he was at moving himself about in these conditions. The skill training memory was finally settling in, along with his natural aptitude, of course. He stuck the comm relay inside the second spiral and hurried back. Wilson stared at the small triangles, inching their way across the big portal's tactical display. Digits flickered around each one, delivering yet more bad news. The lead ship was 82 million kilometers distant and accelerating hard at 8 G's. It was going to reach them in just over 3 hours. That was bad enough, but what he really didn't like was that it hadn't flipped over to decelerate. All 8 ships had launched from the moons or inhabited asteroids of the outermost gas giant, 3 AUs distant, the closest center of any alien activity. If that lead ship didn't decelerate at all, it was going to have a relative velocity of over 7,500 kilometers per second when it reached them. No human machine had ever reached a fraction of that speed in real space. Even now he could see it on the visual display, as the Second Chance's main telescope tracked it. The fusion drive was a streamer of near-invisible violet fury stretching for hundreds of kilometers behind a scintillating golden sphere. Every stray gas molecule and charged particle impacting on the force field was dying in a burst of radioactive splendor, contributing to the coronal hue around the ship. If it hit the Second Chance or the Watchtower at that velocity, the explosion would briefly rival a solar flare.
Only ships 5 and 7 have flipped, Anna said. They're decelerating to rendezvous,
falling a long way behind the others, and 3 more have left the gas giant on an interception course for us. I think we've also got about 15 on their way from Dyson Major. It's a little early to be sure, but their vectors are matching up.
Wilson nodded silently as he absorbed the tactical situation. Given their vectors and positions, all 8 ships in the first flotilla must have launched from various bases over a period of several hours. They were well spread out. There was no doubt about their destination, even if it was only a flyby. As for their intent...
Thank you, he said. Oscar, pull the contact teams out of the watchtower right now. I want them back on board Second Chance in 30 minutes.
Yes, sir.
Tunde, I'm trying to think of any possible peaceful or scientific value from a flyby at the kind of speed the lead ship will have.
There isn't any, sir. There can't be.
That's what I thought you'd say. This is territorial.
They might even think we're from the species which put up the barrier, in which case we have to assume the worst. If they do not slow down, we will withdraw from this system. I'm not going to risk our lives in this mission in an attempt to make contact under a combat situation. Hyperspace, I want an immediate flight path for our return to the Commonwealth, ready to initiate on my command.
Aye, sir.
Anna, we're going to attempt data contact with the First Flotilla. If we can't understand them, maybe we can get them to understand us.
Start transmitting our standard preliminary contact package. Use every frequency they're squirting at us. If nothing else, we have to tell them we're not the ones who put up the barrier.
Captain, Oscar called.
Wilson missed having Oscar on the bridge, although he grudgingly acknowledged the executive officer was by far the best person to be running the exploration of the watchtower. But he knew immediately from Oscar's tone something had gone wrong.
Yes, we've got problems. 2 members of Contact Team A have dropped out of communication.
This one is at a different angle again, Emmanuel said. They had both stopped beside the fifth crosslink, shining their suit lights into it. Once again, it was a straight tunnel opening to a spiral shaft. They suspected there were more than two spirals, possibly four or five. I think we should stick to this shaft, Dudley said. Let's find out where it goes before we start plotting the rest. According to his inertial guidance display, they were already 115 meters below level 7 of the alien station. They hadn't managed to get a signal from any of the additional comm relays he'd placed at the crosslinks above, so they didn't really know for sure what the topography was. Oscar, can we carry on?
Yeah. Keep going. It's the most interesting aspect of the station we've come across.
Dudley pushed off again. There were enough bumps and irregularities in the aluminum sheath for him to grip and use like a ladder, pulling himself along. He was keen to see where it led now. He had a gut feeling that this was important. It was different from the rest of the station. The aliens must have used it to feed something in or out. This had a purpose. Once they knew what it was connected to, they would have the first key, a way in to decrypting the alien culture. And I found it. He moved forward eagerly, his suit light sliding over the ancient corrupted metal, seeking understanding.
I can't get them back, Oscar said. The comm relays must have glitched. We're not even getting a carrier wave from either of them.
God damn it!
Wilson started calling up the contact team status displays onto his console screens.
When did you lose contact? Just as you told us to get them back. I don't believe this. Those comm relay units can't fail. They're nothing but safety circuits.
A 3D chart of the watchtower station sprang up, with other team members' positions illustrated by small green lights. All of them were converging on the beacon.
Who's missing? Wilson asked. Verbicky and Booz.
For one instant, Wilson felt a flash of anger. It just had to be him, didn't it? Anger was equally quickly replaced by guilt. He's one of my crew and he suffered equipment failure.
Don't they have to make their way back if they lose contact? That's what the manual says. Emmanuel knows it well enough, even if Dudley is a little shaky on theory. They should be on their way back.
How far away are they from a working relay?
I don't know. They set up 18 units behind them. I'm still getting telemetry from 16 of them. That puts them about 20 meters away from a working one.
Right, Wilson said tersely. He could imagine it. The two of them annoyed their progress had been halted. Maybe a quick squabble about going back right away, or taking a fast look a few meters ahead.
Should be back online any minute now, Oscar said.
Anna, Sandy, is there any response from those ships yet?
Sorry, sir, not yet, Sandy Lanier reported. They're still on course. No signal, not directed at us.
Son of a bitch. Right. We need to start shouting.
Bump up the power level in the transmission antenna. Make damn sure we get their attention. Aye, sir. McLean Gilbert shot out of the carbon composite tunnel into the beacon compartment. In front of him, contact team members were free-flying out of the gap in the wall. Pale gas from their maneuvering packs swirled in rapid eddies through the beams of the remaining suit lights. Have we got them yet? He asked Oscar.
No. Nothing.
They should be back in range. For fuck's sake, Emmanuel knows what she's doing. How long now?
14 minutes.
No way. No way is that a comm relay failure. They're in trouble.
We don't know that.
I do. He twisted himself around and pushed off the wall, heading for the tunnel that would take him directly down to level 5.
What are you doing? Oscar shouted.
Helping them.
Get back to the shuttle.
I'm with you, Mac, Francis Rawlins said. Mac was already in the tunnel. Light shone on him from behind.
I'll take care of them, he told Francis.
They're my team, dammit. Okay.
Mac, for Christ's sake, Oscar said. Get back to the shuttle, both of you.
2 minutes, Oscar. Come on, man. That ain't gonna make any difference.
Jesus!
The wall is changing again. Look, Dudley said.
He stopped himself and shone his suit lights on the patch just in front of his helmet. Emmanuel drifted up beside him. The tattered aluminum now formed a series of small corrugations. Spaced between them was a yellow ceramic. It had small red markings on it.
That's interesting.
Hey, is that writing? Emmanuel asked.
Could be.
What do you think, Oscar?
We're not sure. Make sure you get a clean video of it.
Copy that.
Dudley waited a moment.
Get it? Copy. That.
Just video the bloody thing, Emmanuel moaned.
Oh my God! Sandy pushed herself back from her console as if it had just given her an electric shock. Sir, missile launch. The lead ship has fired. 8, 9, 12. That's confirmed as 12 missiles.
At us? Wilson asked.
He was pleased by how calm he sounded. 4 of them, yes. The rest are on course for ships 2, 3, and 6. Wilson's virtual finger stabbed at a communications icon.
Mac, Francis, get out of there now. I'm recalling the shuttle in 3 minutes. We're almost at level 7.
The aliens are firing at us. Get out of there. I am not going to repeat this order.
Yes, sir.
The other ships are responding to one's missile launch, Anna called out. Salvos launching from ships 3, 2, 5, 6, 4. Oh, now 8 is launched. Lead ship has fired again. Over 100 missiles in flight. Sir, 24 of them are heading for us.
God, they're hitting 15 Gs.
Son of a bitch.
Wilson spat. Pilot, take us over to the watchtower. We've got to get that shuttle on board. Tuli, is the hyperdrive ready?
Aye, sir, Tuli said. We can go FTL anytime.
Mac's virtual hand twisted the throttle as far as the graphic would let him. He shot out of the station compartment into free space.
His suit sensors locked onto the shuttle, and a bright red trajectory plot streaked across his virtual vision. He steered himself along it, ignoring the amber velocity warnings winking urgently. Francis was beside him, matching his flight. A searing white light appeared from behind the watchtower. Mac flinched inside his suit. Then logic kicked in. It was the Second Chance's plasma drive, bringing the ship in close, cutting down the time it would take for the shuttle to get inside its force field. A time that shouldn't have existed. I couldn't leave them without making some effort to help. I just couldn't. Who knew this would happen? He started to decelerate a few meters short of the shuttle, using his legs to absorb most of the impact. Even so, he hit hard. The cilia on his soles gripped the fuselage grid, preventing any rebound. Francis came down beside him.
Bugger me,
she grunted. Her legs were bent sharply, torso twisting.
Go, Mac told the shuttle pilot. You're not inside yet. Just go, we're secure.
Space around him flared yellow as the chemical rockets ignited.
Oscar had hurried back into the bridge compartment. Wilson acknowledged him with a quick wave as he claimed his console. He was waiting for the shuttle, willing it to cross the gap. Both Jean Duvoir and the shuttle pilot did a superb job, rendezvousing 30 kilometers from the watchtower. A small screen showed the little craft settle onto its cradle, which sank back into the hangar. Wilson kept clenching his fist, which was disrupting his contact with the console interface pad.
Any contact?
He asked for the 10th time.
No, Oscar said. I think Mac was right. They're in trouble.
What the hell kind of trouble? It was dead over there.
Cold and dead. I don't know.
Missile detonation, Anna said. Oh boy, here we go. Multiple blasts. High megatonnage. They're using diverted energy pulsers. Very heavy E-band emission, gamma and X-ray activity. Plenty of electronic warfare.
Where were they?
Ship 3. Attacking and defending barrage. The ship's still intact. Changing trajectory slightly.
Wilson glanced at the forward portal that was tracking the 24 missiles powering toward them. Their velocity alone was terrifying.
We should go, Oscar said quietly.
Right. The second shuttle was on its cradle, a volunteer pilot ready to launch the second there was any signal from Verbeke or Bose.
More missile launches, Anna announced, and we're about to get another round of explosions. There's an attack cluster almost in range of Ship 5.
Any reply to our signal? Wilson asked.
Sandy shook her head.
Detonations, Anna sang out. Shit, it's like the warm-up for Armageddon out there.
Wilson, Oscar urged, it's time.
Captain Wilson Keim took a final look at the tracking display. The missiles were close now, and their true offensive capability remained unknown. He was coming perilously close to endangering his ship and crew. The bridge crew were all watching him. Their expressions of defeat and regret, and yes, even guilt, were the same as his own.
Hyperspace, Wilson ordered. Take us home.